space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Listening to Mad Science at www.shazazradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one, but four separate chat rooms. So, basically, there is this thing we call electricity. I'm going to play something real quick, a little introductory to electricity. Ooh, cool music, man. I'm building up to it. Oh. All right, come on with it. Let's learn about electricity. Introduction to electricity. Yeah, see, that's what it sounds like in my lab.
Electricity is the movement of charged atomic particles called electrons. Moving electrons create the drama and power of a lightning strike. They also light up your room when you flip the switch. A battery is a chemical device designed to create the force needed to move electrons. Conductors, usually metals like copper, provide a path for the electrons to flow on. Electrons have a negative charge. They travel out of the minus end of the battery and are attracted to the plus end. Touch a metal conductor to each end of a battery and electrons begin to flow from minus to plus. Flowing electrons are called current. Current is measured in amperes. The force moving the electrons is voltage and is measured in volts. Never connect a short wire from the minus to plus on any battery. This is called a short circuit. The conductor gets hot, you might burn yourself, and the battery quickly loses energy. The path that an electric current follows is called a circuit. This circuit has a light bulb in it. To move electricity through the bulb, we complete the circuit by touching the metal wire to each end of the battery. The wire does not get hot because the light bulb reduces the current flowing in this circuit. Electric energy changes to light energy. Slowing things down, we can see that once the circuit is complete, an electric current appears, flowing from the minus end of the battery toward the plus end. Side of a typical AA battery, and you will find a capital letter V or the word volts, preceded by a number, usually 1.5. Voltage, or volts, is a measure of the force moving the electrons. It is safe to touch an AA battery because 1.5 volts is a low voltage, not enough to give you a shock. High voltage is dangerous. Never experiment with anything that plugs into a wall outlet.
Ah, I've done that. Ah.
Another important quantity related to electricity is current. Measured in amperes, current tells us the rate that electrons are flowing at. Ampere is often abbreviated to amps. Electrons are very tiny. 1 amp means that this many electrons flow through the circuit per second. That's 624 with 16 zeros, a huge number. 1 ampere is the current flowing through a typical flashlight. The other videos in this presentation explain batteries and show how to construct two different types of batteries using common materials. Follow the links on the menu.
Yeah, follow the links on the menu. Well, that's if I find the play button on it. Stop. Please just stop. Giving me a headache. Anyway, Yeah, if you get an opportunity, if you're on the superchat.html, scroll down underneath there. There's a listing for People Radio, a little nifty banner down there. Go over and say hi to those wonderful folks. There's some awesome people over there. And so anyway, electricity. You know, we come to be reliant on electricity these days so we can have our nifty gizmos such as what we've got right here with our computers able to listen to each other. It's amazing what you can do with electricity just whenever you finally got understanding of how it actually functions. See, there's this thing about nature, there's a force about nature that doesn't get talked about a lot. It's called balance. You know, nature likes to balance everything out. Like I'm sitting here holding a rubber band in my hand, just holding it just loosely in my hand, and so it's at its natural state right now. While I'm holding this rubber band, as long as I do nothing to this rubber band, then it will just remain flexible and you know, kind of wobbly there, just in its natural state. The molecules in the rubber are doing what they normally do, you know. And so if I actually take and put a little bit of force on there, Newton said for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. So if I stretch this out just a little bit, and I can feel the force getting harder, the harder I stretch, the more force I have to put to stretch this out even farther yet. But once I've got this thing completely stretched out, I've got as much force pushing in on my fingers as the rubber band is trying to pull back in the opposite direction. So there's the equal force right there. But the thing about nature is nature wants this rubber band to be right back where it started. It wants to be in a relaxed state of its normal. It's where it came from. And so if I stretch this rubber band really far out and I got all this pressure, which would be the equivalence of voltage inside your power source, your battery, from one side to the next, that release of energy is going to give me the maximum amount of force as much as I've got the tension on that one side. As unbalanced as that is, it's going to give me that much force on the way back. And if you're aiming it at your eye, you might not be too happy with the results. So don't play with rubber bands. Don't learn about rubber band safety by accident. Anyway, electricity works kind of like that. You know, there's a lot of high-tech terminology even in this little video clip that I just played right there about amperes and all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, it's the same concept. You got electrons inside there. And normally when they're in their natural state and at rest, everything's fine. But whenever you stretch out that magnetic field or you fluctuate that magnetic field, it causes a movement inside her. That's what we call current. And so with this this current flow, we can actually get work done. So the voltage, which is the pressure of actually me stretching this rubber band out, that's how much voltage pressure that I got on the other side right there. When I let that go quickly, I get that sudden release. Pow! Alright, there's your lightning strike. There's your arc from one source to another as nature balances that back out immediately. Is there really not no time? You know, electricity is like almost instantaneous. It's an instantaneous balance. It's going to release itself. So we've learned how to kind of harness that power and use that flow of current by resisting a little bit, like what he mentioned in there about the light bulb. If you had just a straight wire connected to that battery, that energy wants to balance itself out so rapidly because it's just a straight, what they would call a short, and it's too much power for that wire to be able to handle. And so that wire is going to get hot. Well, so when you put that resistance, which is the light bulb, in between that wire, you slow that current flow down enough to where the heat that would have been generated in the wire is now generated in the resistor, which is the tungsten or nichrome element inside of any given heating device. So you catch all that resistance in where you want it to go, and basically you generate visible light so that you can see. So it's a real simple understanding of what we're actually doing there. With generators and stuff, if people could actually just take the time to understand exactly what's going on inside there. You know, some people don't even believe the electron even exists. They believe it's something else. But nonetheless, conversation purposes, that's what we're going to say. That's what's going on there. You get electron flow, and how much electron flow you got is going to tell you how many amps you got going on inside there, and then you can do the calculation and amps and times watts and all that to get amps times volts, whatever, into watts. I don't even like all that high-tech stuff there, the mathematics. I just want to basically get down to the basic concept of what's actually occurring right there. Because once you figure that out, you're going to know how to get the most powerful punch, your most work out of what you're trying to do there. I put a video out yesterday called Rotary Switch 2. I posted that link over there in the Shazoo's radio chat room. And I'll try to repost it around in case anybody hasn't seen it. But I've been talking a lot lately about a rotary switch. Now, they've already had commutators out there in this world, and there's all kinds of different versions of them. But back in the old days, they used to have a distributor for your car, and essentially that was kind of like a timing device to allow all the spark plugs in your car to fire in a certain sequence so that you can run your car. But either way, the same concept kind of applies the way this thing functions. But the power from the coils that was generated every time that coil pulsed, when that rubber band was stretched out, when you put the power to that coil and it stretched out to its maximum of potential of how much power you actually put to it. Now, the more voltage, the more power input you put on that deal, the more tension is going to be built up inside that coil. And once that energy is actually released, you got the equivalence of a micro lightning bolt going in through that system. And so the power of that electricity that was just traveling through there, all that voltage pressure, is quite literally enough to eat through metals, eat through different types of materials. I mean, it's a really super powerful force. And so they had to figure out a way to dampen that, because otherwise the points in that distributor wouldn't last very long, because the powerful force of that snapping back every time you put the power to the coil and you let go of it and into the system and it snapped in there, it was doing damage. That's how much power is available in your average coil system in your vehicles. It's a lot of power. I mean, they actually use that same concept for welding. You know, they got a big old welder with a heavy current or whatever transformer inside there, and that much current flow, and as fast as that energy's coming out and as high the voltage is on there, you can literally heat metal up and weld metal to metal and such. So we understand what we can actually do with that force. But to get the maximum efficiency out of it, we got to go back down to the basics of just like what I'm trying to explain here with this rubber band. And it's all a matter of timing. If you take a look at this rotary switch that I put on there, it's just a crude model that I kind of put together, and it's all wobbly and everything. I actually got a comment on there that the guy said, "Oh, look, the bearings are already shot." You know, no, the bearings weren't shot. It was the manufacturing that was shot from the get-go, because the CDs that I used on there, they didn't glue on straight, and everything was kind of wobbly from the beginning. But nonetheless, it showed the proof of concept was fine. Everything worked like it was supposed to work. But if you actually look at what's going on inside of here, when you put power to a battery, from a battery to a coil, you induce a current through that coil, and it shifts all those electrons inside that copper wire, shifts them around, and starts to pressurize and produce a magnetic field. Once that magnetic field's to its fullest potential, the moment you let that thing go, here's how you can test this theory out, what I'm trying to tell you here. Get any coil, any little transformer coil or whatever, and take a little 9-volt battery and put the two wires on, one on the positive, one on the negative, while still touching the 9-volt battery and the two wires at the same time. And when you first connect that thing to there, and the power in that 9-volt battery tries to follow that circuit and transfer the electrons from negative to positive, you'll have basically an electromagnet in your hand, but you will not get shocked. So you can sit there and hold those wires all day long, and they will begin to heat up because of the resistance to that current flow. That is actually, once that battery and that coil is balanced out, you're not going to get anything. It's just going to be an electromagnet until one of the two gets too hot and can't take it anymore. Either way, all you have to do from that point on is leave one of them connected while touching the other one, keeping it touched, and pick that wire up off of there. And once you do that, all that energy that you just stored up in that coil wants to rush back out of that coil. It wants to go back where it came from. Well, it's going to take the closest path, and that's right through you, and you will get an electrical shock from doing that. So, at the time when you touched those two wires, you didn't just pressurize that coil. You also pressurized that battery. There's pressure inside that battery because now nature's sitting there trying to balance these two things back out and not wanting to accept electrons this way and wanting to accept them that way. You want just wants to be back where it started. And so the moment you release that, you'll see an actual arc come from that battery to that wire and vice versa at the exact time that you pull that loose and that thing tries to snap back to where it was. That's electricity. And so now that you understand that, and you understand that you could actually get a lot more powerful source or use out of that energy with this rotary switch, what's actually doing is it's making contact with the battery, pressurizing both the battery and the coil of wire, and so now you've got this massive power potential. You've got this rubber band stretched way out there, and the moment that switch lets go, pow, you get that surge of power. You get the full amount of that power. See, we can do some really fast switching with transistors and MOSFETs and stuff like that. We can actually flip the switch on and off real quick, but what's not happening there is that it's not completely releasing that hold on that magnetic field. And so you're not getting the full amount of that power. And some of that energy that's trying to come back up out of that coil while you're pulsing that is trying to force its way back down through there, which causes resistance, which ends up causing the transistors or the MOSFETs to get hot. That resistance, that change in current flow right there, it went up one way and it ain't got nowhere else to go but right back down to the other deal. And so the faster you pulse that thing and the more current you try to put to the other side of it, the hotter that thing's going to get, and eventually it'll just burn itself out because the material reaches its thermal breakdown and it won't be able to handle it anymore. This is why this rotary switch is important if you want to build a really powerful generator. I'm talking about a generator that, you know, is going to get the full extent of that force of that rubber band stretching out. No kind of nothing in the middle that's either going to slow it down or only allow it to go so high. And you can actually adjust the power of that magnetic field by slowing it down and speeding it up. You can control how high that voltage actually gets. See, the frequency of what timing that you do at this, we turn that switch on and off, on and off. The faster you turn it on and off, the more that field expanding and collapsing raises the voltage level up there way high. So you can get really super high voltages just by turning that power source on and off rapidly and bumping that wave up every single time until you got high-frequency waves like you use for energizing gas into plasma state. So that kind of voltage right there, really super high voltage, isn't something you can run your appliances off of. You actually need a steady current flow, and you need a timing to where you're getting the most amount of current flow and the most amount of voltage and the most amount of power out of that generator. And so you have to be able to time this out. That's what this rotary switch does. It allows you to gather energy from the battery and from the coil, both on the connect and the disconnect portion side of it. So you're catching the voltage as it's going through one way, and then you're catching the voltage pressure as nature's balancing it back out the opposite way. With this rotary switch, there's six contacts on this particular one, and so you could have six separate brushes on there. You could actually use the same rotor and another set of brushes to switch that motor on and off. So basically, when one of those contacts hits that there's two wires or two brushes, then it would turn that motor on, spin it up real good, and then instantaneously shut that off. And on that shut off, because you just induced a current inside that electric motor, when that current wants to balance itself back out, you're also getting fly back off of the motor as well. And so all this energy, once you understand how it's actually functioning, you can capture it from the motor that you're using to drive the switch, and you can capture it from the power source that you used to start the thing to begin with, and you can capture it from the flyback of the induced coil balancing itself back out. So you got three power sources in one, initiated from the first power source, which was your battery. Your battery is a chemical battery, and it's trying to get these electrons from this side to that side to balance that battery out to its natural state. Every chemical and everything involved in the battery, when you got an electrolyte that's charged, the negative plates are higher pressure potential than the positive plates. And those two plates want to be back to their natural state. Whatever that lead in that battery was when it was before you introduced that chemical, whatever that was, and when you charged it up, whatever the pressure was on the side, whatever it was before there, is where it's going to want to go on both sides. So if there's extra electrons on this plate over here, then they want to go over there where there's more room to breathe. When it's all balanced out, that's what we'd call a dead battery. And so we actually, when we're charging up a battery, we're basically throwing those two plates out of balance. So one of them has more electrons than the other. And by that motion of what's going on there, that electricity flowing through there, if it flows through rapidly, it's like just releasing that rubber band all in one shot and pow. Alright, so if you take a steel bar and you go up and stick it right down onto a 12-volt car battery, it's blatantly obvious that bar is going to get really hot really fast. You're going to get a reaction. It might not be a very good one, because as that connection's being made, you get electrolysis process going on inside there, and you're actually producing hydrogen, because inside that battery, we say battery acid or electrolyte or whatever, there's actually water molecules in there as well. And through the electrolysis process, you separate the hydrogen and oxygen. Used to be in the old days, they had on the batteries, they said you got to be careful, because they had like a warning label on there that these batteries would produce hydrogen. The moment you connect any load to that, it's actually doing the electrolysis process, and it's actually producing water, or hydrogen, and basically oxygen, so everything you need for a fire. So if you took that steel bar and you put it on there, and the hydrogen began to flow in there, and then as you release that steel bar, because it's too doggone hot, and that arc from one terminal to the next, as this energy is flowing through there, is enough to ignite that hydrogen, cause that battery to explode and spit nasty battery acid all over you. So once you got that understanding of what's going on, now there's a whole lot of things that could be going on here. See, a lot of people are into making hydrogen cells, and they take a couple plates, like a couple steel or stainless steel plates, because stainless steel doesn't get as messy as a lot of different metals. If you've ever seen the electrolysis process, you'll see that it's actually pulling rust particles up out of that whatever type of metal you used inside there. And those plates will actually destroy themselves and crud up the water inside there. So any of the iron in there is going to make that thing look messy as all get out. And so you use stainless steel, and that kind of lessens it. But even in stainless steel, because there's not a perfect purity to stainless steel, then you're actually still going to get that deal, and your hydrogen cell is going to look all cruddy after you run it for a while. But nonetheless, it will still, with the electrolysis process, separate the hydrogen and oxygen. So, now that you know that, and you know how the electrolysis process works, whenever you're putting electricity to those two plates, and there's a path for that electricity to travel from plate to plate in there, it cracks the hydrogen and oxygen molecule apart. The water molecule separates it and releases up, I can't remember which side was a negative plate for oxygen and positive for hydrogen. One, it could be vice versa. Doesn't really matter. Nonetheless, once you know that, you could actually guide oxygen into one tank and hydrogen into another tank, because the hydrogen molecule is smaller. You can put a filter, a really tiny in a micron filter, that will only allow hydrogen molecule to fit through. On the other side, will only allow, would allow both of them to fit through, but if you had them separated right properly, the oxygen would go one way anyway, and the hydrogen would go the other way, and you'd have pure oxygen in one tank and pure hydrogen in the other. But knowing how that battery works, knowing that that battery has the capability of producing hydrogen, so you could use that battery as a hydrogen generator while you're actually using it to run your lights. I say, I hadn't heard a lot of people even think about that kind of stuff, but on that battery, there was a warning label that said it does that. And most of those older batteries are vented. And so that means that once you start that light bulb, and that electrolysis process is occurring because of the two separate plates, the positive and negative plate inside there, you're getting not just the reaction of that current trying to flow from one plate to the next, but you're also getting action inside there where the water molecules are, and you're producing hydrogen. And if that was a sealed lead acid battery, like the modern day ones, which are more like in gel, they're not in water, like you would see in the old style batteries where you mix some distilled water with some battery acid, and now you got that deal. But in those older batteries, they had to have a vent on there, because that pressure of the hydrogen and oxygen separating would actually cause that battery to bulge out, and if you didn't have some way to release that pressure, it would, you know, blow a hole in the side of the battery and basically cause the thing to leak, or worse. And so, that the old style batteries, if you go look at them, they have an actual vent on there. But knowing that, and knowing things about how batteries actually do the work and the vent process and stuff like that, and knowing how hydrogen, how dangerous hydrogen can be, and knowing about the size of the hydrogen molecule itself, and the fact that you can actually separate the hydrogen and oxygen into two separate directions, now you could actually design a battery that may not last as long as the other battery, because unless you keep flushing it, you could actually design it so that you could continuously flush it after every charge, and then after so many hours you could flush it with fresh electrolyte and clean off any crud. And then once those plates were completely deteriorated, then you'd have to replace the battery. But nonetheless, in the process, you get the power from the battery through the light bulb, and you're producing hydrogen and oxygen at the same time. And as long as you're keeping a fresh batch of it, and that thing can never go dry, then the battery will remain to be good. And as long as these plates don't get crudded up in between the two, and short one plate out, where now you got one dead cell in a 12 volt battery, so now you're only down to 11 volts, and that ain't going to work for what you need. As long as you keep in between those two plates clean, that battery will last as long as the material in those plates will last. And so you don't have to make these out of lead. You could make them out of aluminum. You could make them out of any type of metal. There's just certain types of metals that seem to be less resistant to basically tearing themselves apart. So you could actually make a battery. I took two neodymium magnets. One was a sphere and the other one was a little flat one. But all I did was take a little salt water and put it on a piece of a cloth and put these two magnets together and basically produced a little chemical battery. But because the one was a sphere, there wasn't a whole lot of surface contact. I needed that surface contact so you could get more of the reaction going on in a larger space, will give you a whole lot more voltage. So the more plates you got inside there, more sets of positive and negative inside your battery, you could make the biggest battery you ever wanted to. Voltage wise, and depending on the surface area, current wise, and all that kind of stuff, instead of just a 12 volt, which has six sets of cells in there, that each one of them probably produce like 2 volts a piece or whatever, then you got a 12 volt battery, you could put a couple hundred sets of twos in there with a lot of surface area, and you could make a really super powerful battery. And a hydrogen cell to boot. So using that energy in a more efficient manner is what I'm basically trying to show people, to try to get them to understand. And with this rotary switch, if you watched what was going on inside this and you step back and look at the big picture, I show in there where I got three hard drive magnets connected to that same switch on the rotor. On these CDs, I glued on 3 separate neodymium hard drive magnets, and then approximately, I'd say probably about 3-4 inches away from that rotor, I had glued a little plastic shot glass on there, and I put in a neodymium sphere so that you could actually see real time the reaction between these magnets over here and that neodymium magnet, because every single magnetic field, including an electromagnet, whenever you induce a current into the coil wire, it will have a specific size according to how much pressure you've actually put in to from your battery or your power source into that coil. That field will expand that far, all right, depending on how far that field is. If there is another field anywhere in the general vicinity, those two will interact with each other. Any two magnetic fields in a general vicinity will interact with each other. And that's how we're able to make electric motors. Some of them use they'll use a coil on one side with electromagnet, and they'll use a coil on the other side with another electromagnet, maybe in the opposite polarity, and these two are either going to repel or attract each other. and that's how those two interact. But if you're watching this video and you see, there's actually something to do with timing as to how long, when these two magnetic fields come into reaction and they to react with each other, there's a time that if everything's just right, it will take these two magnetic fields and they will align themselves according, you know, opposites attract, positives repel, that kind of deal. But there's actually a time in there. And they actually have to have enough time for this reaction to take place. So if you watch, when I speed that deal up there, the neodymium magnet inside there, the faster that rotor is turning, the less that neodymium sphere moves inside that cup. But if I slow that thing way down and give it enough time to completely react with that magnet, then you'll start to see that magnet spinning around in the cup. And at the right, the perfect speed, that magnet will spin around inside that cup. And now those two changing magnetic fields, an anomaly occurs, and it will actually, the neodymium sphere will actually begin to start to assist that spinning motor while that rotor is going around, and you can watch this thing physically speed itself up because of those two fields flip-flopping next to each other in perfect timing are helping each other push each other around. So, if you really paid attention inside this rotary switch and you think about the implications of what I just explained to you, you now have the capability of building the perfect electric motors and the perfect electric generator systems. If you go back through a lot of these videos where I show all these little anomalies, any given one by themselves, they're not going to be that important. You know, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I can't run my house off of this one, or I can't run my house off of that one. It basically is what you'll end up hearing by somebody. I'm going to try to click over on my YouTube real quick. But basically, I spent all my life studying how things work. But the last 20 or so years, I have really got in depth in studying exactly how magnetism and electricity travels. Because in order to understand that energy and how to utilize it in its best manner, you need to know a few things. What's actually going on right there? Whenever you're generating electricity and you want to use it, and you want to use it as efficiently as possible, you need to understand how this stuff is actually moving. As far as to what electricity really is, and the terminology, or whether the electron theory is, the closest thing we got to an explanation of what's actually occurring, the simple of the explanation, such as this rubber band, will tell you everything you need to know. And if you're watching that video and you see that the magnets, the hard drive magnets that's on the wheel, on the CDs, glued to the CDs, interacting with that other magnet, you can see the same exact result. To get the maximum amount of power out as you put in, as much as you put in, you're going to get right back out. And to get the maximum amount of work done, that's what you need. You need to be able to get as much as you put in out without any losses to the system. And that's what this is going to give you capability of once you understand what it is I just said. Because when you see that at the right speed, that thing is barely moving. It's just turning just real slow. And that gives the full time for that change in the fluctuation in that magnetic field. That's how we generate electricity, is the changing of the magnetic field from one pole to the next, from north to south. Stretch it out, let it go, stretch it out, let it go, stretch it out, let it go. and how fast we do it will determine on how much electrons flowing at any given time, and it will determine on how high the voltage is. So the faster you flip that switch, the higher the voltage rises up there, and voltage, high voltage is pressure, and it will travel really fast. If you actually go take a look at how power lines actually function, you'll find out that around here it's anywhere from 7,000 to 12,000 volts of electricity, high frequency AC, that they're sending down the power line to get power to everybody out there. And they do this nifty little trick when they finally get it to your general vicinity. They start to store it in a combination capacitor / step down transformer. And once they do that, that gives you the pressure and the current and the frequency that you need to be able to transfer that into your house, anywhere from a 100 watt, 100 amp service to a 200 amp service, you know, single phase, dual phase, or even three phase electricity, gives you that from that pole right there. But the key to note, and one thing that Gerard Morton was trying to tell everybody, he says that electricity is actually radiation. Well, in some sense, the terminology is perfectly correct, because you're sending a high frequency wave down a line, which is interacting with all the atoms, electrons on the way, and actually bringing more energy from out of the wire into the wire, and so increasing it. So as you're sitting there vibrating this ring, that's the frequency that's radiating that energy down that power line. And so when it finally gets down to there, if you understand how that they're actually doing that, and how efficient it is, and how far you can actually travel, send that that power to where you need it, then you'll understand why it is that I've been telling people and getting myself into trouble by saying, I don't care about current watts and amps. It doesn't require all that to get done what it is that I need to do. Because all I've been wanting to do is to understand that energy to the extent where now I can move that energy anywhere I want with the least amount of resistance and get it to a certain state to where whenever I either want to turn it into plasma or I want to pressurize it and use, now on the opposite side, now your current watts and amps come into play. Now your mathematics once again apply. Because when I stretch this rubber band out, it don't matter whether or not I do it slowly and let it go, there's still as much force in that rubber band as I put into that rubber band, and there will always be as much force. So no matter what you do, according to their own laws of physics, energy can neither be created nor can it be destroyed. So as much energy as you start with, it's still there. Newton said, for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. So if I put this much force to it, I'm going to get that much of a reaction out the other side. And so it's not that we don't have enough energy, it's just that we're not using it to its maximum potential. We're not understanding that we're either spinning something too fast, or we're trying to shove too much power through a system, and once that system trying to compensate for as much power as you're trying to cram through it, it's generating resistance, which is generating heat. See, if you want to generate heat, you do it on purpose, and you have an electric heater. But if you do it improperly, you have an electric heater that is so incredibly inefficient that it costs you a lot of money to run. But if you understand how this concept actually functions, you could put a tiny amount of voltage to the system and still get the same heating result, because you now took that tiny amount of voltage and you turned it into a high frequency, high voltage wave that was a lot of pressure that you then in turn charged rapidly capacitor banks that you could turn around and now have all that pressure that you just built up in the system and then let it go rapidly in through that wire, and that sudden surge and current flowing through that wire causes that wire to get hot because it's trying to resist the change in the magnetic field. It's trying to resist the flow, the current flow. So we could actually build electric heaters that would work so ridiculously efficient just by doing on purpose what the industry has done either by accident or intentionally in order to sell you more electricity and more fuel. So what I'm trying to say to everybody out there, regardless of whether you believe in free energy or not, if you just want to go by saying, well, there ain't no such thing as free energy, okay, go ahead, whatever. You know, you can believe what you want to believe. I don't care. Just let's for argument's sake, let's agree that we're not looking for free energy. We're looking for efficiency. And if I can take the same amount of pressure, this resistance of this rubber band, as I put that pressure to it, I got that much power available. And I know that in whatever manner that I release this, if I release some of the tension and then let it go, I'm going to get less of an impact. But if I pull that thing all the way out there and then I finally let go, pow, I get a sudden impact. I understand exactly how electricity travels. I understand exactly what is going on there. Nature's trying to balance itself out. And so now I can take that knowledge and I can design the perfect electric motors that basically use every bit of what I've been trying to show everybody. And that's why I'm clicking over on my YouTube channel for a reason, because I did a video called Rotary Switch, also did one called Important and Energy Now. Some of these videos I probably should have renamed them, but I wanted to, if you go back and watch these doggone videos and you listen to what it is that I'm saying in there, all the way back to the plasma water heater, and there's so many of them. I got like 277 videos on there, and in every single video, even the crazy ones, I put a little nugget of something in there that you watch that doggone video, and what I'm saying right now is going to make perfect sense to you. Because, like I said, it isn't that we don't have free energy. It isn't that we don't have enough energy. There's enough energy on this planet to do so much there. And once you actually learn about what's actually going on with nature, and knowing that you can quite literally manipulate the electrons and protons and neutrons that are in the atmosphere, there's so much that we could do. We should be so much further advanced, and probably we are, but the governments of the world, they're not going to tell you that they can do this kind of stuff. I mean, everybody, if you go out there into the conspiracy world and you listen to everything that's going on, maybe all of them's right. Maybe they are doing all this kind of stuff. Maybe they really do got UFOs, but maybe the UFOs are homegrown UFOs. Who knows and who cares? Seriously. Because if that technology's out there, and this, and every bit of technology, every bit of nuggets of all this information, including everything from teleportation to time travel to, levitation or whatever, anti-gravity, what they say called anti-gravity, all that, every single bit of it is scientifically possible using all of these anomalies, like anti-gravity. You know, if you've got a positive and a positive trying to push each other, two magnets, they're going to push each other away. Well, if you understand how electrons and protons and neutrons and all that kind of stuff works, you know how to manipulate the environment around you. We know materials that are magnetic, non-magnetic, paramagnetic, diamagnetic, all these different high-tech terminologies. Once you understand what these dang materials are capable of doing and how powerful a magnetic field is, you know, there's actually, so far, they haven't found a material that will perfectly shield out a magnetic field. Magnetic fields will just travel right through any given object. Now, A radial wave, on the other hand, which is a magnetic field, it will travel through the through every single material. I don't care what kind of material you want to talk about. But the difference is, depending on the type of material, that wave will slow down until when it comes out the other side, it's not recognizable by your radio or your cell phone. Such as all that cell phone tower energy, it's actually coming through the walls right now. All right. Well, it's not at the same frequency that my cell phone recognizes, so I can't pick it up. I can't hear it. But nonetheless, it's still there. And so all that energy, every bit of it, we're in a pool of it. And it's just like jump out there in the bathtub or swimming pool and sit there and tap on the water in different areas and watch what's going on there. And you'll see exactly what I'm saying as far as how magnetic fields travel. They don't travel in just a straight line. They go in all different directions. It expands out in every different direction. It's like that doggone rubber band. And crazy thing about it is, we talked about the doggone rubber band, how much force for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. I put this much force to this rubber band, and I'm going to get that much force once I let it go back to its natural state. But in the process of doing that, I just shot my computer with the rubber band and slapped myself. Anyway, but in the process of that, you got not just the energy from how much I put into it, but you also got the energy force of as it's actually cutting through the atmosphere. You develop a acoustic wave, and you can hear it. You can audibly hear it. And when that finally slams into something solid, you hear that as well. And if it's like on your finger, whenever you do that, you're going to feel it. So there's a heck of a lot more power available than what we're being told. It's so much, there's so much more power available in any given battery. You'd be surprised at how much energy is in one little battery. Now, I don't care if it's just a 1.5 volt pen light battery, a AA or AAA or whatever, it doesn't matter. There is so much power potential in that battery, it is incredible. If you understand how to use it like Tesla tried to show everybody, whenever he was pulsing those Tesla coils, think about modern physics. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. And so whatever he put in, he was going to get back out, no matter what. But the results of what he did with that is basically where the whole concept of over-unity came into being. Getting out more power than you put in. Because if you just calculate the power that you put in as to the power that you get out, and you just calculate that alone, then no, you're not getting out more power. But if you calculate the results of what just occurred while you did that, when you're sending that wave through there, depending on how high that wave is, you're actually, because of how fast it's moving and how fast it's beginning to interact with the atmosphere that surrounds it, that result, not only from the high voltage arc that you're going to get across, produces an acoustic wave all the way through the deal, and so you're hearing an audible sound as this frequency is raising higher and higher. You get this high pitch wee going on. If you listen to my videos, a lot of my videos, people complain because there was this high pitch sound in the background that drove them nuts, and that was the high frequency that I was using to generate the plasma. So they were hollering about, well, that's not that much power over there, but what about that acoustic wave over there, that energy wave on the side over there, which is a result of what I just did right here, can actually be utilized. You can put a piezoelectric crystal anywhere in the general vicinity of that high-pitched sonic wave that's going through there, and you can generate yet even more power using that reaction there. So when people started talking about over-unity and the fact that there's no way to get out more than you're putting in, they're only counting the one source. They're not counting the reaction of how fast this electricity slams in there, and for every action is an equal and opposite reaction, and the reaction of the power release that's going on in there. Like if I take an 800 microfarad capacitor and I fully charge that, using only maybe 12 volts to start, but I pressurize that to the full 800 microfarads, and I take a screwdriver and I put it down on top of those two terminals, I can literally watch as the power released from that capacitor literally welds a hole in the metal. So, as much power potential that was inside there, and that instantaneous release, and that a sudden rush of power had a reaction with not only itself, but the screwdriver, but the environment on there. And had that have been my thumb, I would have blew my thumb completely off of my hand with an 800 microfarad capacitor. Matter of fact, my wife thought I blew myself up because she heard something sound like a shotgun going off in my lab, and it was just me discharging a capacitor. That's what I've been trying to say all along, folks. You know, and I catch a lot of grief, but if you actually sit down and contemplate on what it is that I'm saying to you, then, you know, you take things like Raymond's two-stage oscillator, where he's showing you how to get more work done for less input. That's efficiency. The amount of power that he put in, he got it out. Exactly as much power as he put in, he got out. But because he understood leverage and because he understood physics, he was able to raise a heavy weight on the opposite side with less input than it actually took for him to actually do the work to begin with. And people will sit there and argue till they're blue in the face that he's not getting out more energy than he put in. To some extent, they're right. But they're not counting in all the other factors of everything that is in play at any given time. If you raise this particular object up several feet off the ground and that took that much work, it's going to take just as much work for you to manually bring it right back down. But if you take it up there, you get it up to the top, and then suddenly you let go of that, the power release from that one episode is going to be mind-blowing. Probably crack a hole in the concrete as that steel weight slams back down towards the ground. The acoustic wave that's going to reverberate from that reaction is just going to probably blow somebody's eardrums out, or at least give somebody a heart attack on the other side who didn't expect it to be coming. So, it's just about understanding how this energy is actually traveling. That's the key. If you pay attention to nature, you see how nature does stuff, then you can learn a lot from it. Those hydroelectric dams that are running out there, they just take a force and they utilize that force, and then they produce electricity, which then in turn they can raise the frequency of it up, raise the voltage up, drop down the current, or vice versa. And they know how to manipulate the energy that was coming in as the water is moving right on by. And once they had their system in place, they had free energy that they then in turn sold to you. And it's the same thing with everything else. So the coal-fired power plants, the nuclear power plants, it don't matter where this energy came from. If you dug it out of the ground and you burnt it in order to get this, and they're all saying about how inefficient they are, that's because they don't understand what it is that they're doing. If they took this energy, don't matter what type of fuel input, and they used it to its maximum potential, then they would have perfect running automobiles. There's no reason why we couldn't have an electric car to recharge itself right now. The only reason why is because the doggone people will make excuses for the industry. Well, you know, if they could do that, they'd already done it. You know, of course, they always have our best interest, right? Sure. No, it's the best interest of the wallet. That's what the key is. But nonetheless, Let's give them that. And then they'll turn around and they'll say, well, you know, it's just more expensive to make electric cars because you got all that copper wire and stuff. And, oh, man. Every single resource that was on this earth in the beginning is on this earth right now. You're never going to run out of copper. You're never going to run out of any material that you could name off. You could name any material that you want. You're never going to run out of it. It is physically impossible to run out of it. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. Oh, well, you know, when you're talking about water, fresh water, we could run out of fresh water because, you know, there's only so much fresh water. The most of it's all salt water, you know. Oh, where do you think the fresh water came from? It just magically there? No, nature filtered that water. And you was able to drink that water. Nature filters that water in many different ways. It evaporates it up into the air. It comes down in the form of rain somewhere else. Fills up over there. You know, every chemical on this planet has a purpose and it's in its proper place. If everything's in balance and then everything's fine, you got fresh water to drink. But if you're naive enough to believe that we're ever going to be able to run out of water, then you need to go back to science class. Sorry, not trying to be hateful, but that's just the way it is. The earth is over 3/4 covered in water. There are people on this earth that paid attention in science, and like over there in Dubai, they built huge desalination plants, and not only do they make money off of the sea salt extracted from the water, but they actually got fresh water, and they're doing just fine. And so they use the byproducts, they use the regular product, and no matter what happens to any of these products, when it gets consumed by the consumer, it gets recycled back into nature in one form or the other. Every single thing that was here in the beginning is here right now. So the scarcity of resources is probably by far the most ridiculous lie that science has ever perpetrated on the people of the world. And the energy, the fact that we have to sit around and argue with people who are supposedly educated over energy, electricity and such, and free energy, is just proof positive that number one, they overthunk it. Is that a word, overthunk? They overthought it or whatever. And they were seriously indoctrinated by one point of view, and that's the only point of view. You know, there were people that said to the Wright brothers that if God wanted man to fly, he'd have put feathers on you or whatever, but give you wings or something like that. Well, they said that they were going to fly. Everybody mocked and laughed and ridiculed. Oh, it'll never work. And they had to listen to what those morons were saying who didn't pay attention in science and physics and an understanding of what they see with how nature does it. That we could replicate it? Well, if they'd listened to everybody and they'd have gave up, then we wouldn't have the airplanes today. But you can blatantly, obviously see that we do have airplanes. And even in the modern jet industry, they are running these engines so incredibly efficient, and they say they use thousands of gallons. If you do the math on it, there's some more questions to be asked. How you putting 80 some odd tons more weight on these planes and not snapping off the wings, or there's just so many questions to it. So these engines, which are compressing air and actually burning part of the hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen that's actually in the air, in the process of producing thrust, which the majority of the thrust from a jet airplane is coming from the wind that's generated by the fan as it's being blown through and sucked through, and actually producing a vortex in front of the plane, sucking that air in. And so quite literally the plane is getting sucked through a vacuum forward, and using thrust on the back end to keep the plane moving forward. And the faster you drive this thing, the more efficient it becomes. The hotter the inside of that engine is, the more efficient it becomes. Because now you got an instantaneous separation of hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen for fuel. And so you don't have to use that much fuel. They learned how to do it. And they learned how to sell you a seat for several hundred dollars to go from point A to point B on it too. So even in their fuel, they're not going to tell you if they got a good fuel economy. They're not going to say, oh look, we figured out how to, once we get this thing started with a little bit of fuel, keep it running, pick our fuel up on the way, and so to lighten our load, we can carry more luggage and such. It's still going to charge you a higher price, because as the fuel prices go higher and higher, you know, because of supposed scarcity, then they can put that cost over on you, even if they're not burning that much fuel. So that's why I call it mad science. Because if you take the whole thing in consideration, the physics of everything that we're talking about here, we can make our engines run incredibly efficient. We can generate our own electrical power on site, right here in where we live. Now you imagine if you could build yourself an engine that would replicate what the jet engine does, to be able to take, like, say, a turbo off of a car and compress that air. You know that once you compress that air, since the air is a gas, when you compress a gas, it gets hot. So now you just generated heat. So if you want to make a perfect heating system for your house, you replicate that process of compressing that air and putting it into your house. You take the cold air from one side of your room, you suck that cold air in through that compressor. That compressor smashes that air down, makes it really hot, and shoves it out the other side back into the room. So you've got a turbo compressor that is heating your room, and the only input that you needed was an electric motor to spin that fast enough to compress that air. Now see, on your automobile, it actually uses the pressure of the exhaust from the engine to turn one side of the turbo, which turns the compressor side of the turbo that sucks air in from the atmosphere, compresses it down, and once you compress it, you're pushing all that oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen into a tighter container, and you put it down in through an intercooler, and then that pressure comes up, and then it's rammed down into your intake, which raises the PSI inside there in your combustion chamber, and plus adds more oxygen and more nitrogen and hydrogen into the fuel source, and gives you that mega boost that everybody likes in the hot rod scene. So now you know how that system works. Now you know how, if you could take air right out of the atmosphere and compress it and make it hot, and then if you also know that on the other side of the spectrum is that if you compress that gas and you let it release rapidly in through an expansion chamber, that will create a temperature difference. Now you have air conditioning. So everything from HVAC, heating and cooling, all the techniques that they use in a closed loop system, which is your air conditioner or your heat pump system, can be utilized. All those techniques right there. So you could design this generator to produce a massive amount of hot air. You could then in turn take that hot air, which is compressed gas, and allow it to expand rapidly, open up a big wide volume, and aim that right back at that same engine, and that heat exchange would cause that engine to cool itself down. So you could actually cool it down with its own exhaust while extracting the heat from that compressor, because that compressor is going to get really hot. If you look at the actual air compressor and you take and don't ever do this. I mean, if you do, use a thermometer, put it on there. But run your compressor, air up your air tank, and then turn around and put a temperature gauge on that compressor head from the friction inside there of that piston going up and down and the compression of that air into a hot gas, basically, and then down into that tank, pressurizing that tank, that compressor head is going to be really super hot. It'll burn your hand after it runs for a while. And so you got a heat source right there. And using you can capture that heat off of radiantly, like an old the old heaters that they used to have in old buildings where you run steam through them and that radiant heat goes out through your building or whatever. But either way, by running an electric motor to run a compressor, you just took that energy, kind of used it inefficiently, because after a while the electric motors seem to get really hot because of the way that they do that. If they were actually going to do this properly, they would make sure that that electric motor was nowhere near the general vicinity of the compressor head, but they're all tightly packed in there. So the ones that are sitting way over on the other side of the tank with the motor and then running the belt, those are probably going to be motors that last a lot longer than the ones that modern day, because that heat's transferring from one side to the next. And if they actually design the motors themselves to be efficient, you get the most bang for your buck, so to speak. But either way, using compressor technology and all these little anomalies that I keep pointing out, you have the capabilities to quite literally build a perfect power source in your general vicinity using things that are already on the doggone store shelves. Everything's in the junkyard. Running one of these doggone compressors that they use, basically the turbos that they use inside there, you know what the job of that thing is. It compresses the air. And if what I'm saying is wrong, then take the intercooler out of any turbo engine, turbo setup of any hot rod or whatever. Take the intercooler out and just allow that direct pressure and heat go inside your engine and see how long it lasts. You might be surprised. Without that intercooler cooling that back down to a reasonable temperature, it's going to basically cause your engine to overheat. So understanding all those basics right there would give you so many different options of so many different ways in which you could use existing technology to make your own power generators. Now, there's treadmill motors out there, I think anywhere from 24 volt to 30 volt treadmill motors that are permanent magnet motors. And if you can use the knowledge of what you could actually do with water, you know, boiling the water into steam, everybody knows about steam power and how powerful it is, or compressing the air, you know how powerful that is. All these different techniques is enough to overcome the force that's going to be, when you spin this thing easy, when you take the doggone electric motor and you're going to be using it as a generator, before you put it under a load, it'll spin real easy. And now that you got the knowledge that once you put that under a load, like turning a light bulb on, now you're going to have to put more force in there because these two forces are trying to equal themselves back out again. You just put power to one that's trying to fight with the other. Now, you move that energy away from that generator. Don't ever allow it to come back. And then you will be able to utilize that same amount of energy because you did not lose anything. And you don't have to keep trying to fight something in order to get the power output. Well, this rotary switch that I keep talking about, it takes and it maximizes the amount of power that can be got back out. If you watch in there, those neon bulbs, they say it takes about 60 to 90 volts to energize that neon into plasma. So 60 to 90 volts coming from a 9-volt battery, that's not a bad deal. And actually in that video I had two 9-volt batteries, so even if we say we go up to 18 volts, well, you know, whatever, 16 volts, 9 volts, yeah, no, it's 18, okay. Don't ask me about math. I don't even think about it. But anyway, You got 2 9-volt batteries, 18 volts total, being used in the system. You're generating anywhere from 60 to 90 volts times 3 because there's 3 doggone neon bulbs going on. So it took at least 60 to 90 per bulb to energize that into the fourth state of matter, being plasma, which I'm pretty impressed with neon gas, because if you actually check the temperature of those bulbs while you're doing that, if you want to make a plasma heating system, then neon's probably going to be your best bet on there. Because for some reason it's a lot easier to energize neon and then some of the other gases. I mean, they all do the same thing eventually, but neon seems to rapidly raise in temperature up inside there. So you're running it even with a 9-volt battery, getting that neon going inside there, you can actually reach down and that bulb is getting hot. So that tells you. That's another thing, heat. No matter how you move energy around, in which direction, you can control how much temperature you got, because if you understand the resistance, everything's going to resist. Nature's going to resist. When you want this energy moved from point A to point B, if you're not sending it in the most efficient manner, which is at a higher frequency, so that it's basically just cutting right through it, skimming right across the deal, when you're trying to shove a whole lot of water through a window screen, you're going to meet a lot of resistance. And if you take and send a really super fine stream, it just goes right through the window screen. It doesn't even slow it down. It might splatter a little bit off in different directions if it actually hits the parts of the metal, but it'll just go right on through without any kind of resistance. If you understand how water flows, you understand how electricity flows. Once you understand how electricity flows, and just a simple look, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, folks. All you need is a basic understanding of what materials do, what energy does, and you take those and you put them in the right doggone order, and you got everything you need. Perfect. Perfect generators, perfect electric motors, perfect heat sources. By using energy to its maximum efficiency, and that's what I've been trying to show people for the longest time, energy is free. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking, and you haven't been paying attention to mad science. Because what I've showed you doesn't defy any of the known laws of physics, doesn't defy any of science. What defies any of all of that is the terminology that I try to use. Because if I'm not a mainstream scientist and I'm not using all this high-tech terminology, then the science guys don't think I know what I'm talking about. But you know what you're talking about whenever you see water flowing down one direction, and you know from experience of what you saw and what kind of reactions got out of that. And if you explain that to me in your terminology of what you're understanding and what you're seeing, the physics going on there, that's real science. That's scientific observation. But because I don't understand the high-tech terminology of what a doctor wants to tell me about some sort of, your epidermis is showing. Why didn't you just say my skin? All right, just something that basic. I understand. You know, you didn't have to get all high tech. If I run out there and tell the average Joe that there is a plethora of hydrogen and oxygen molecules emanating from the sky in the form of precipitation, otherwise known as rain, I could have saved myself a lot of breath just by saying it's raining outside. But instead, I want to make myself sound important and intelligent, and so I went into that big old long rant of high tech terminology that the average Joe is looking at me cross-eyed because they don't understand. Energy is not complicated. Physics is not complicated. Science is not complicated. my buddy Two Dog. I wish he was around here. I'd bring him on this show because he's in the science of nature, because he's actually paying attention to nature. He's like thinking he didn't have what it takes to stand next to old Shaziz as far as bad science goes, but we did one of the best shows we ever did when he was on here. Because his understanding of how nature functions is science. That's real science. And what I'm trying to show everybody and what I'm trying to bring back to everybody is real science. Not that hoodoo, voodoo version of Scientology and all that kind of stuff where you gotta love your reactor. If you're a jerk, you don't get free electricity. No. You don't have to love your reactor. You have to build it. That's that. Because unfortunately, there are brilliant individuals who are just incredibly lazy. It's sad. But if they could get somebody motivated to do it for them, they'd help by explaining, that's it. As you can see in my video, Rotary Switch 2, my manufacturing skills suck. When somebody said, well, look, the bearings are already burned up out of there. No, the bearings are just fine. It was the materials used, the lack of precision in building it, is the reason why it wobbles all get out. But the proof of concept on there was perfectly fine because it did exactly what I said it was going to do. And had there been even better brushes on there, then it would have performed yet even better than what it did. That's the key. Craftsmanship. Things like what Jermaine does. I mean, the kid's a craftsman. He is a wonderful craftsman. Brilliant, brilliant kid. And it's craftsmanship that matters. I got a person out there, Sky Collection. I always watch his videos and I'm always complimenting on his craftsmanship, because not only does it work like he said it is, it's fine. So, anyway, sorry, somebody was contacting me on Skype. Anyway, once you understand the craftsmanship, makes a big difference as far as precision and balance. See, that's the whole key about everything, and one of the reasons why they like to, let me see, I'm going to try to add somebody in here real quick. Once you understand the efficiency and all the different types of machines out there that are working really good were precision made. They were balanced. They had compensated for every possible thing as far as shifting from side to side to spin to lubrication, and all that precision made the difference why that thing was working as well. Now, taking all these concepts like I just showed on this rotary switch right here, if it was made in a precision shop to do exactly what the explanation of what the purpose of that rotary switch is, and then you use that rotary switch to pulse any coil that you got, it doesn't matter. You don't have to, any transformer. Because those coils, they don't care where that magnetic field comes from. They don't care where the change comes from. That's all it's looking. It's just looking for that change, and that nature's going to balance that change right back out. So if you take that same battery that you had directly connected to a load, or even to some sort of a mechanical oscillator, or even a relay switch, and you have it doing the same job, you'll note that that relay switch is going to get really hot and all that kind of stuff. Where all you're doing with this right here is basically what Tesla was doing back in the day, and turning it off and on at a certain rate. And by that certain rate, you get that magnetic expansion of that field right there. And once you put that power to that, from that battery to that coil, That magnetic field will expand out to the full potential of how much pressure that you actually put into that coil from that battery. So if it's a 12 volt or whatever amperage battery, you put that much power to it, that's how strong that field is now set up inside that transformer. It is now an electromagnet. You just magnetize that transformer. And until you release that, you have no current flow. You had current flow on the way out because you had a change. And then once you release that, you have current flow on the way back as it as nature's setting it back to where it was to begin with. And so using this switch concept that I'm talking about, you're going to be able to get the power from the battery, utilize it on the way by, and you're going to get the power from the transformer and use it on the way back as well. And in the process of doing that, depending on at what frequency range and how you utilize the current flow or the voltage, will determine all the side effects that you'll get in and that you have that you can use, such as acoustic waves, heat from resistance or whatever, and you'll be able to utilize your transformers in such a incredible fashion that the transformer itself will not get hot. They only get hot when they meet resistance. When you try to put too much power through any given system, then that's the reason why they get hot. So, hey, how you doing there? Justin ain't heard from you for a bit.
I've been good. Yourself?
Pretty good. Talking about efficiency today, man. I'm getting things together so we can put things in a more efficient manner.
Go to sound.
Huh?
Go to sound.
Sound?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the ways to actually manipulate energy. Sound waves is a more efficient way because you could actually use all kinds of different technology, such as diaphragm and piezoelectric. And when you put a small amount of power to, let's say, an amplifier, for example, and you're actually able to raise that acoustic vibration up to crazy levels, or even just a really fast sound wave, that you can actually cause that fast sound wave to resonate with any given object, such as a tuning fork or whatever. It's like when you was telling me about cutting rocks with sound. It's, folks, it can be done. It is done. Has been done. You can cut rocks with water. You can cut steel with water. You can, if you understand how energy actually travels, and you understand the makeup of materials, all that kind of stuff, it's like twanging this rubber band right here. I can actually adjust the tune of the rubber band by how much pressure I put to it. So all the energy that we're talking about is already right there in front. Nature, it's just how you use it. That's the efficiency level. And I just lost my rubber band because it shot clear across the room. So what do you think, Justin?
Well, in any of our electrical, mechanical, hydrodynamic, any of these devices, apparatuses that we use, utilize, they're all 5, 10%, 15% losses in between conversions.
Yeah.
Right, like, if I have, let's say, just an inductor, a coil, And I pulse a frequency to that, we know that we can send that through the air. And we can have a receiver pick that up. But that itself is just sending a rarefaction and a compression rate through the atmosphere.
Yeah, and as far as the losses,
that was the shooting for.
As far as the losses, if you understand where the losses would have naturally occurred, you can compensate it for them. And in all reality, the word losses is actually a misnomer because you didn't lose it. It just went off in a different direction because of the way that you tried to, you know, put something through there. You know, whether it be water or whatever, if you try to cram too much water down a pipe and it backs up and spits out the side, that would be considered a loss. But if you've got the perfect tube to match the volume of what it is that you're actually sending, or if you actually understand that, like, just sending a radio wave through the air, that all these molecules that are floating around in the air, is actually going to slow that wave down, and so it makes you have to work harder to get through the system, and so that would be considered a loss. But if you understand that you could actually speed this up or slow it down to just ride the wave that's already there, then you have absolutely no losses. You see what I'm saying?
I wouldn't, like it's not a, really, a, like you say, it's not a loss. At the point of the transition, the emission, the heat, the transfer, it is, not all of it goes into the other system. It propagates into the atmosphere. We call that a thermal loss, a heat loss, right?
Yeah, but see, that's because
I know what you're saying. If I was to reference it like this, if we take a digital transmitter and an old analog transmitter, right?
Yeah.
One, the analog transmitter propagates in all directions.
Yeah.
Whereas digital transmitter is guided in one direction. There's minimal loss.
Yeah, it's focused. That's what I was trying to say, you know. And your receiver makes a difference as well, because if you're not able to receive a certain amount of power, then you're going to get those losses that you're trying to cram too much power in there. So even in the systems that would be the least efficient, if you back that power input because you didn't need as much as you're trying to cram through there, you're just trying to like maybe clear up a signal or something like that. So you force more power out there, but in the process, some of that power on the transmitter bleeds off on the sides, and other people get upset because you're coming over their radio too, see?
I got a question for you, Shiziz.
Yeah.
Can you design a specific tuning fork to excite fluorescent light bulbs?
Well, yeah, you could actually do that with any tuning fork. If you have a way that you can quite literally... Let's say I make me a relay switch, all right? And I got this tuning fork on this relay switch so that every time that I induce a current in the coil, that it causes this to vibrate, all right? Now, I can take this specific frequency, which the tuning fork is made of, and I can cause this thing to actually go to its natural frequency. Like this one that I got in my hand is at 329.6 hertz. All right, so when I bang it on anything, I will get 3.296 hertz. Well, if I take and I get this thing going, and I vibrate the crud out of this thing and keep on vibrating, the faster I vibrate that, the higher that same frequency is going to get. I'd be able to raise that frequency level up to, you know, incredible amounts, to where the actual material itself still has the same frequency, but I'm raising the level of that frequency up to a higher waveform. And when that higher waveform interacts with the gas, see, right now a tuning fork is interacting with the gas in there. It's interacting with the atmosphere when you bang it on the table. Let me pull one of these things out of here and see if I can bang it on the table. But
so do we need what we call electricity to actually?
I don't know if you can hear that, but
you know,
I'll see if I put that next to that vibration right there is actually interacting with the atmosphere, and that's why you can actually hear an audible sound from a tuning fork if your ear's close enough to it. But the further you get away from it, the atmosphere is actually slowing that waveform back down. But if you had the tuning fork quite literally surrounded by that gas, and there's nowhere for that gas to go, and you start to resonate this tuning fork, and you do it at a higher rate of input that you did than just banging it on the table, then you can raise that frequency up enough to interact with that gas inside there to the extent where it energizes it into plasma state and light that light bulb using sound.
Right. So anything from a transformer to a capacitor to a windsurf machine to anything, an inductor, they all interact with the atmosphere.
Yeah, everything does.
If you hear a lightning crack,
there's several things going on there. You're not only generating a lot of heat, a lot of voltage, but you're generating a lot of heat, you're generating light, and you're generating an acoustic wave that is the thunder that we hear.
Everything in electricity and magnetism is the study of atmospheric physics.
Yeah. Everything around you, it's all interacting with each other. That's why that rubber band example was so important, because if you understand, like, Newton's law of for every action's an equal and opposite reaction, as much force as I put with this rubber band, once I get it out there, it's going to maintain. I have to hold that much force in order to hold that back. Well, I can also feel that much force pulling back on each side of my fingers that I'm stretching it out with. And depending on how I release this, whether I release gradually a little bit of power and then release it all in one shot, or whether I just release it all in one shot, in the process of that, it produces an acoustic wave as it's dragging through the atmosphere, and then as it crashes into my other thumb, and then as you hear me say, ow, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, it's understanding those forces.
So the word that is called for terminology, it's called magnetocrystalline entropy, and what this means is that it takes more effort to charge the domain of the metal. Like if we have aluminum or copper or gold or brass or tin, or any of these different values of metal, right? Some take more energy to transfer that energy. And this is where we see those propagations of what we would call losses. So the flow, that transfer of energy, takes more energy to do it. Any kind of electrical apparatus or mechanical apparatus that we use is going to have some sort of loss.
That's because they haven't paid attention to the physics of what's actually occurring. Now, whenever I say, you know, if I take and I go by Newton's law for every action's an equal and opposite reaction, I know it's going to take this much force to stretch this rubber band out this far. And so mathematics would say that it took me this much power, this much force, in order to stretch this rubber band this far. And so whenever I release that, I'm only going to get the amount of force, that how much pressure that I exerted on that, I'm going to get that on there. And so what they're not factoring in is all the side effects of what's going to occur depending on how I release this deal right here. And so, if I release it rapidly, I get a sudden burst of energy, and pow, nature's done balanced this rubber band back down to its natural state, and it's all floppy again. I got to exert the exact amount of force that I want to use. So, I'm never going to be able to get out more energy than I put in. But what I can do is I can take that energy, and I can utilize that energy to the maximum potential. I mean, I get the full force of when that rubber band pops, I get that to get work done, alright? And so, with that said, in the process of doing that, what would have normally been considered losses, as that rubber band is actually dragging through the air, producing an acoustic wave or a pressure wave or whatever, all of that is usable energy as I release that. So even the losses that would be basically calculated in to prove, disprove that you could get any more out over unity or 0 point. You know, that whole over unity or 0 point energy is just basically a distraction. It's a waste of time, because I know how much power I can get from popping this rubber band. Alright? And I know how much work that I can get. And I know what it takes to actually get that work to be done. So I'm not going to lose anything. I can.
How much force? Huh? How much force is lying on us at all times?
We got tons of force pushing down on us, pulling on us, pushing us in every direction.
So, is the elastic band already not stress? Is it already not under force pressure?
Yeah, but see, so everything once it's in the environment and it reaches its natural state where it's most comfortable, this rubber band right here is all flexible. All right, it's just like you happy go lucky, and if I just let it dangle there, it's just fine. It'll come to rest. It'll finally come to rest. But anytime I do anything with it, I spin it around in circle, I start to change the makeup of that doggone rubber band. I start to change what's going on inside there. And at a certain point, I can actually get this rubber band to get hot enough where by spinning it around in circles, it's going to melt itself. It's going to reach its thermal breakdown from flying around through the atmosphere and rubbing up against the hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen molecules and dust molecules. All that friction that's going on there will cause this rubber band to get hot. And eventually, it'll change the material once again. So once we figured all that out, we're not doing anything more than moving energy from one place to the next. That's all we've ever been doing. Period.
So if you want to take atmospheric pressure and transfer it, you have to make something to convert it.
Yeah, you just got to slap the water. You have to have, when you slap the water, it sends a ripple out from the, how much you slap that water will determine how far that ripple, how fast you slap it will determine on the frequency of the waves that are propagating from every direction from where you did that.
Can you see the pressure? Can you see the atmospheric pressure around you?
Well, you can see it if you have other things like water, blatantly obvious. You can see the water ripples going through there. If you had something to, you know, because of the size of the gas or the clarity of it or whatever, you know, you can't physically see a radio wave going through unless that radio wave is going at such a frequency that it's quite literally energizing the hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and whatever gases in the atmosphere into plasma.
Magnificent.
Yeah. But yeah.
So what I'm trying to get at here is, if you take a sphere, a copper sphere, a complete sphere, a round hollow sphere, and you were to hold it up in the air, the pressure that lies on that sphere from our atmosphere has a capacitance to it. That is a self-charging capacitor.
Well, yeah, the whole world is a thermoelectric generator of epic proportions. It's got piezoelectric, it's got thermal electrics, everything. I mean, it's just amazing. The whole entire system of this planet, all right, planet Earth, flat planet, whatever, it don't matter. I don't care. The way that nature's set up right now, there is more energy available than we could ever use in a trillion, trillion, trillion lifetimes. We could never run out of energy.
If we utilize the Earth as it was once utilized, as a rotor stator, because the moon and the Earth themselves is a rotor stator, and we know that when you take a magnet and you put it in towards a coil or a plate, right, it induces it. The moon goes up and down and in and out. That itself should be clear enough. If you take a piece of granite and you take a big 52 neodym magnet and you could launch it across that granite, it does the same effect that we see with aluminum. It grabs a hold of it. It induces the granite. And we look at the pyramids, one's red, one's black, and one's white. Those are the same electrical wiring that we use today.
Well,
if you look at all the pyramids around the world, all of them, not just one, they're in the same linear waveform that the moon is in, but opposing. In the opposite direction.
History may not have necessarily been explained in its truthful context is one of the reasons why the Mad Science Show actually exists, because everything that I'm explaining right now, I'm pretty sure that they knew back then, and they did some pretty incredible things. But now we're in a situation to where the masses of the world are pretty much enslaved by the system itself, as far as the power companies. You're only enslaved by your own mind, because if you haven't paid attention to mad science, then you don't know how to generate your own electricity. Electricity is just a side effect of interacting with what nature's already provided. Magnetic fields, whether it be a permanent magnet, or whether we generate an electromagnet using knowledge that we can actually induce a current in certain types of materials, whether it be copper, aluminum, you know, any material out there can be induced a current in. It just, some are not, they resist the flow, or they're not as conductive, you know, the high tech terminology for everything that you can come up with. But nonetheless, copper seems to be the best one that we use right now because of its affordability. But there are better materials such as gold, or, you know, other, you know, high dollar materials that would allow electric flow to go a lot more smoothly. But even, let's just say, just sticking with copper, because it's been around for so long, it's, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just using it to its maximum potential means that you can take that same battery and you can get more work out of that same battery than you would have had you done it the old-fashioned way. Like, you take that battery and you connect it straight to an inverter system. Well, obviously, that inverter takes so many currents, it takes so many watts in order to be able to run, and it has a drain on that battery. So if you got just your standard average inverter and you're running a load on the other side, it's going to drain more off of that battery faster, and maybe that battery will only last an hour. But if you understand what's going on in that system and where your losses are, you can compensate for that by using all the wasted in that system, such as the power MOSFETs inside the doggone inverter. They only have a thermal breakdown of a certain high temperature, at that particular temperature, it will fail. That part will burn up, and you have to get a new one. And so, instead of allowing this thing to ever reach that temperature, you can take that energy off of that same system right there, and redirect that energy right back to the system, the battery that you're pulling the doggone thing off of. You can take that thermal heat, transfer it without having a direct connection to that, and so it's an independent system of itself. It's just taking the heat from the same inverter and taking it away, which is keeping the power MOSFET from getting too hot. And as long as they don't get too hot, their resistance won't get to the point where it starts to become even less efficient. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's a perfect example of what I was facilitating earlier.
Yeah.
A MOSFET. What is it made of?
Silicone.
So it's not really made much different than a pyramid is it?
No. See, if you actually look at the pyramids, they look like some sort of either hydrogen technology, or some sort of piezoelectric, or maybe a combination of both, and maybe a combination of sound resonance from, if you notice, there's these like tunnels that come down from different angles, so it's almost like a whistle. If the wind's blowing across that, there'd be a wave that could rush down that deal, and that pressure wave as it hits inside the chamber would actually cause a reaction. It would cause the materials inside there to reverberate, which in turn would cause a piezoelectric effect. The water from underneath of it, as the temperature rose up in there from this vibration, could actually cause an evaporation and separation of the water molecule, releasing yet even more power inside there. So you could take it from so many different directions of what they could possibly have been, but nonetheless, it's something to look into.
So everything about our modern electrical, it is all about rocks.
I don't know about the whole rocks thing, but
well, as the MOSFET you just agreed that, yes, it is. Everything from our computer to our
materials and minerals
with rocks.
We know that all the materials that are out there, every single material under the sun, they all interact with each other in different manners. And you mix this one with that one, you get a battery, you know? And so everything, every material, and even, you know, the way that electricity is generated, you know, like thermoelectric, for example, you got any two different metals and you heat one side of it, you produce the Seebeck effect, which is one of the, you know, scientific theories out there that causes electrical flow. So as this exchange of electrons, everything's trying to balance itself out, you're actually getting electricity just out of heat. And so, yeah, everything, the earth itself, the rocks, the wind, everything that's going on is energy. The key is taking all that knowledge and putting it in the right pieces of the puzzle. You know, a free energy machine is the earth. There's tons of free energy. You know, these people that always come complaining about why we can't do this because there's too many losses, you can't do that, that's because they still haven't understood what's going on there. The viscosity of any given oil, you know, is basically a high-tech terminology for the thickness of the fluid, and what we want to do with that oil is actually transfer heat away from parts and keep it lubricated so that we don't generate friction, which is the problem which causes that heat, which causes things to thermally break down. But we have technology now to where we can make synthetic oils that will have higher resistance to heat and more able to cause bearings to be able to run smoothly without ever getting friction. You know, essentially like frictionless bearings, you're quite literally riding on a liquid, the bearing sitting there floating on top of this liquid, and so it's not meeting any resistance, and so that heat's transferred away, you know, by the flow of that deal, you know. And the same thing would apply with you know, any other portion of what we're talking about right here. I talked about earlier where you could take turbo technology and you can compress the air right out of the atmosphere. And if you got a direct couple from a high-speed electric motor and you're running this motor super efficient, you're never putting it under a load outside of the fact that when that is sucking air in from the atmosphere, it's compressing that air, and then anytime you compress a gas, it will generate heat. You're going to get heat in the compressor itself, and that energy could actually be transferred into thermoelectrics. And you're going to get out the exhaust, you're going to get hot air coming out of that exhaust. And depending on how you allow this exhaust to come out will determine on whether or not, if you allow this gas to expand rapidly out the other end, then you'll get a cooling effect out that into that turbo. If you allow that hot air to be contained and slowly released out of there, you're going to keep hot air coming out of that turbo. So you could turn your average car turbo into a heater and a heating and air conditioning just by understanding the physics of compressing a gas and expanding that gas, the thermodynamics of the whole process. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's there. It's just what... You know, I put all this information out there, and I'm just trying to show people these are the cause and effects of what you do with this particular material, and this is what kind of reaction you get. All these little nuggets. If you take every bit of one of them and you look at electricity completely different than you did before, and you start to understand the whole current watts and amps thing, that's only good if you want to measure how much you're using on the other side. It doesn't matter when it comes to how you got that energy there. And so, if I understand how to produce a magnetic field, and I understand the timing of when I want to release that magnetic field, if I want to get that full amount of power out of that, then I have to know that there's a certain amount of time. It takes a certain amount of time to blow up that balloon. And when I release it, it will take a certain amount of time for that balloon to collapse back into its natural state. And so if I want that full amount of power inside that balloon to be utilized in the form of work, then I have to allow for that balloon to completely empty itself before I fill it back up again. You see what I mean? And so, by understanding that, you would get the maximum efficiency out of your transformers and such. And if we want to raise the voltage up, and then all we need to know is that we got to just hit this rapidly, real fast, all right? And we'll raise that voltage up. I was getting, out of a 9-volt battery, I was getting over 1,000 volts out of there. And you can actually do it in less because they sell them on eBay. There's little systems where you can get, you know, thousands of volts out of a double-A battery. And so it's just proof of concept what I'm talking about. But once again, you can move high voltage rapidly because of the way that it actually travels. As far as the current flow, there are resistance, whether it be the atmosphere or the material that you're trying to send the electricity through, is going to be resistant to that amount of current flow. That's why if you take a wire and you connect it from one end of a battery to another end of a battery, it don't matter what size the battery is. There's a lot of power potential in there. And that sudden connection, that sudden rush of all that power trying to move from one side to the next is going to meet resistance and cause that thing to get hot. Alright? And so if you transfer that, a little bit at a time, the portion of, like using a resistor, the portion of that backflow as that's trying to make it through there, that resistor is going to be hot. You see what I mean? That's how come a light bulb is able to work. The heat is specific to the resistance of whatever you're trying to run. Does that make sense to you, Justin? Did I lose you?
Some of it makes sense, yeah. Like, you know, we got a solar panel here with some batteries and a 1,000-watt light bulb. You know, it works. You know, it's growing all the plants. The plants are good and everything, and it's off the grid. And yeah, so that works.
Yeah, or even inefficient systems, they still work. I mean, all these ones that I keep complaining about, they still work. They just don't do it to the best of their ability. They could be re-engineered to be so incredibly efficient that the input would be ridiculously low because. For any battery that you got, a little 9-volt battery, there is more power potential in a 9-volt battery than you can possibly imagine. Most people don't understand how powerful a 9-volt battery really is because they don't understand how to utilize it. They know if they put it in their radio, you put a 9-volt battery in your radio because of the way that the radio uses that energy, that radio might last maybe a month. I've actually seen batteries last a year, you know, because it's not using it like a regular big resistive load would, like an electric motor would be. You know, it's not allowing a lot of flow of that. It's not giving that battery a chance to rapidly deplete itself by balancing itself back out. So all of these...
A good example of what you're talking about is if you have a speaker, a cone, right? That cone would be a certain amount of volume of air, right?
Yeah.
Which would be V equals 1 times the height times pi times radius cubed divided by 3 of a speaker, right? So you're moving a certain amount of surface area, net force of air. If you were to take a 4x4 sheet of plywood and hold it up on a roof in a windy day, the amount of energy that you're going to need to take to keep that yourself on the roof and from flying off is a lot. You can't save energy no matter what. You know what I'm saying?
No, it's just going to disperse itself and it's going to take the path of least resistance in every single direction. So even your losses, every single every single bit of energy that was on this planet, when this planet first came in existence, is still on this planet today. Every single material, there is nothing on this planet that we've ever got rid of. According to their own physics, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That goes with everything, because every single thing out here is made up of all the same types of materials. It's all still here. It just got recycled into the system.
What I was getting at is, if you have two different batteries, there has to be a difference in between the batteries, because you have to have a speaker.
Yeah.
And that speaker is picking on the atmosphere. If you set the speaker at 50 hertz, and it just vibrates at 50 hertz, and then you stick in the other battery, you might get a difference in time, length of battery life, but then that, you would have to look at the engineering of the battery, because they're both in the same system. It's a closed loop system.
Yeah.
So there's something going on with the battery. Not, the apparatus is still the same.
Well, the thing about it is,
what you're giving a description to, I'm very well acknowledged of it. If we were to take single phase 120 at 2 amps and run something, and then we were to take two phase at 240 and then go to 3 phase, 4 phase, 5 phase, we can actually take the math formulas, look at the math formulas, and see that the amperage goes down with every single phase. The voltage is going up, the frequency is going up, the wattage is actually increasing, but the amperage is dropping in the formula. So we're getting to the end result of wattage the same as we were at 120, but we're using less and less heat. So therefore, we're having less propagation of the atmosphere in the wires. There's no loss in the wires because of your frequency. Your frequency is how fast we're moving the domains, and those domains are what we specifically look at in metallurgy, right? Like copper. Copper moves at, in milliseconds, it would move at 3,650 times per second.
Well, the whole key about this is it all boils down to the simple of, it's how we're using the energy is how we're going to get results. And if it's getting hot, then that means you're putting too much power to it. And because that magnetic field, that's not what generates the heat. It's the backup of what the side effect, like the eddy currents that are produced. If you can think about like a waterfall, at the base of a waterfall, when all that water is falling off of that height and down and slams into that water, it's only got so many places it can go down that river because of the banks of the wall containing that river in, and so it's backing up in there. That backing up, you'll start seeing little whirlpools going around in there. That's the same thing that's going on in any given material. When you're shoving that much current through there, you got these little whirlpools down in there producing resistance, which in turn is producing friction and heat and so on down the line. And so once you understand that and you allow that current to flow freely through the system, you still got the pressure that you need to do the work. You can just back it off just enough to where you're only using what you need to use. So these hydroelectric dams that are out there right now, they're producing more power than we should be using. Way more. If we were using them properly and from start to finish, how we're actually using that energy as it flows right on by, those magnetic fields will interact with each other.
We are using it properly. Remember, you, the local guy that paid for the production of that plant to be built, and your forefathers paid for that and actually built those plants. We did build those motors and generators correctly.
Yeah,
we
are not. What I'm trying to say, though,
on the three phase now, are we?
No.
Only businesses get the discount.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, right, though, is that, like what you're saying, the difference between single phase and double phase and three phase being more efficient, like a 220 heater or 220 is more efficient than 110. All
right,
but nonetheless, we still use a whole lot of 110s. And overseas they use theirs at 60 hertz or 50 hertz, and we use ours at 60 hertz. Ours is obviously going to generate more eddy currents because we're cramming more energy in there than needs to be, which causes the products to get hot and fail earlier. You see what I mean? So, just by the frequency of what they decided to send it to us at and run it at, we're probably, if somebody does the math out there, they'll probably find out that overseas they probably buy less electrical appliance less frequently than we would buy ours over here, because it would, you see what I'm trying to say here? Ours would fail first because they'd reach your thermal breakdown quicker. Because of the frequency that we're putting it in there. We're shoving too much power through these. And by shoving less power into them, then they would run more efficient, which means that more people would be able to turn their lights on.
We gotta remember, though, too, right? Like, if we're running a 540 in our house, you're dead versus 120, right? You can stick your finger in the outlet right now, and you're not going to die. Maybe. You might if you got heart problems and this and that. And, you know what I mean? If you stick it in there and hold it in there. But if you're going to stick your finger in 540 or even 220, you're dead. So you got to remember safety here, too. Like, it's not just the obsolescence and getting rich off of the little guy. Safety is an issue here.
Well, yeah, I understand that. Your common sense has got to come into play there, too. But there's ways to move energy around, because we know at what frequency ranges how much current flow and amperage involved in the deal, whether or not it's going to be safe or not. But we can actually move energy to where you could quite literally do just like Tesla and be hit with thousands of volts and not die because you don't have the amperage there to kill you or anything like that. But nonetheless,
right.
Those thousands of volts are just as much power as it would be if you compress this power back down into a sealed container and that pressure built up, and now you allow that to release rapidly. Now you're in the danger zone again. You see what I mean? So you can move the power through the lines perfectly safe to where you could run up and stick your tongue in the light socket and it wouldn't do nothing to you. But if you want to be able to use that energy like you do now, you have to have some sort of adapter to bring it back into that much current. You see what I mean? It's how we're moving it is the key. You know, when we're trying to use it the way we're doing it, we're basically allowing the system to fight itself in order to run. And the key to free energy for the average Joe is just some simple understanding of how this energy is actually traveling, and that's what I'm trying to bring to the table. A simple explanation and observation of what's actually occurring according to what science says that this is supposed to be, or what the physics say, without violating any of the known laws of physics, putting the tools on the table where you can take any already existing, maybe already even thrown off into trash. Do you realize how much good materials are sent into landfills every single day? It's ridiculous how many washing machines and microwave ovens, those transformers. I was pulsing 7 transformers with one little 12-volt battery, with using one little inverter circuit. And it's because I understood how that energy traveled that I was able to reduce the resistance, which kept the relay from tripping because it was trying to draw too much or push and pull whichever direction it was coming from. But it was allowing that magnetic field to energize all these coils at one time. So all these transformers run in series with each other and back around to the final output portion of the inverter circuit. They were all energized. So I got 7 for 1, if you understand what I'm saying. Instead of just pulsing one transformer, I was able to pulse 7 transformers and get just as much high voltage out of each and every one of these things, just by using it more efficiently. So in line with all the circuits that were already running, if you change the direction of where these transformers were actually setting, instead of having them from wire to wire running in parallel, where it's obvious that you're going to start draining more power and it's going to require more power, because for every one of them you meet resistance, which slows it down and gives less to the next guy and so on down the line. But if these are all run in series, and you know how that AC wave is working, and the magnetic field's expanding and collapsing, regardless of whether it's on a single line or a dual line, then you get more bang for your buck. It isn't that, it's that we aren't using it properly is why we're getting the results that we're getting. In line, two microwave oven transformers in line with each other, one on each line, and then a light bulb in the center of it would make that light bulb more efficient than if you tried to take that and flip one of those transformers around and run it off of the secondary on the other side. You see what I mean? You're still going to get
The transformers that we use are not the correct transformers anyway.
Well, I know those that, but...
The true transformer is actually called the transducer, and it's a U-shaped iron core, and the coils are, it's just like at least scallions, horseshoe magnet, as they would call it. Those were all the original ones in our cars, those were all the original ones in our fridges, in our washing machines. If you go back and you look at all the patents from the old days, so those were the transformers. They were called transducers. Transducer is just another word for, like, amplifier.
Yeah, well...
Or regulator.
Basically, the only thing a transformer does is it changes energy from one form into either a lower form or a higher form, a higher frequency or current flow. You know, step up, step down transformers. All we're doing is taking a higher frequency wave or pulsing of, you know, the induction that's actually occurring whenever you're flipping the light switch on and off, and changing it from a voltage that we can't use because it's either too high or too much current or whatever, and using those physics to step it down to something that the system that is designed on the other side to use less won't burn up. It's that ridiculously simple.
Right, but remember, the biggest thing in the transformer is not the coils.
No,
it's the coil.
The coil is just nothing more than the railroad tracks. The material.
Right. It's the transfer of magnetic.
Yep.
From one coil to the other coil.
The key is understanding how when you're blowing that balloon up, which is the magnetic field, when you release it, it's going to snap back. You know, you release it quickly and you get a powerful punch. You release it slowly and you get a lot of current. And so what I'm trying to show with this rotary switch and all these little things that I'm trying to explain to everybody about is how to get the most efficiency out of that, the most power out of that, so everything gets used. And if you're not meeting a lot of resistance, if it's not backing up in that thing, if that thing's getting hot, you turn the input down and bring it back down to where it's not getting hot. If it's getting hot, then that means that you're trying to put too much energy and it's not able to flow through the other side fast enough. You see what I mean? It's that backup of energy that's causing the waste. And so we can regulate these things to the extent where we can keep them from ever failing. The only time a transformer fails is when the insulation around the copper wire produces a dead short because it fails. When the insulation cracks or burns off, and instead of 1,000 turns on there to help strengthen that field, by when all this is aligning, every little magnetic field that's being produced when you're doing that is adding to each other. They're all combining and making one really strong magnetic field. Well, once that doggone wire is all contacted each other, you only got one magnetic field going on, which essentially is a dead short, and so suddenly all that power can rush through there at one time and cause that to get extremely hot, extremely fast, and smoke.
The iron core is actually, the transformer is actually a good thing to talk about because it shows what we're talking about with losses.
Yeah.
Well, we take a copper winding and we wind it around an iron core. The magnetic field that's produced is 1,000 times greater. The ends of those iron cores, if you left them open, if you can take a watch battery and connect it to those copper windings, and you'll be able to pick up a car, depending on the size of, you know, the windings and this and that. Like, if you take 2 ohms of resistance of windings, you'd be able to pick up a car with a AA battery.
Well, yeah, that's why I kept trying to say that people don't realize how much power is actually wasted in a transformer, because there's so much power potential in that transformer. That's the reason why they get hot. The reason why they make them out of laminated. See, the soft iron will magnetize and demagnetize at a pretty fast rate, so you're able to get that change in the magnetic polarity. You need that change in order to induce the current flow through there. Well, when we go to things like ferrite's got a bunch of different types of materials in there, but it also allows it to, at a higher rate, a higher frequency rate, be able to expand and collapse these magnetic fields to get that change at an even faster rate. That's why they use ferrite cores in radios and anything that has to do with sound or music or whatever, because you don't pick up a lot of background noise and stuff like that, or produce unwanted background noise. So that's why they use ferrite. But also, ferrite can be used to raise the frequency of the voltage to extreme rates, so that you can energize gas into the fourth state of matter, being plasma. Well,
right. It depends if it's ferro or ferrite.
Well, the resistance in the iron laminate cores is going to be more, because it holds that magnetic field longer than it would be in the ferrite, which basically releases the magnetic field more rapidly. It's able to magnetize and demagnetize more rapidly. That's the key. So in the iron cores, they're backing up and causing the eddy currents. It's causing it to get hot because those little whirlpools from too much energy in there. And if you could sit there and measure the magnetic field from way away from the transformer, you could pick it up on a radio from clear across the other side of the room. Take an AM radio and walk around your house. You can hear the magnetic fields propagating through the air. Of course, they're obviously weaker the farther you get away from them, because as those magnetic fields are coming out into the atmosphere, they're interacting with the atmosphere, and that frequency slowing down. It's meeting resistance of the air around you. And so it's actually slowing down, and at some point dissipates. But nonetheless, it's still there. It's just at an extremely low rate. You see what I mean?
Right. For the listeners, if you're wondering about the things that we're talking about, both the movements and the metals and stuff, you can look up magneto restriction, dipole moment, magneto moment, polarization, orientation, hysteresis. Yeah, add that up.
Hysterias. You gotta have everybody all hysterical. Those are some good points to be made. If you want to look up science terminology on that, those are the ones to look for. Give you explanation of what science is saying is going on. You know, putting it in the simples, what I'm trying to do. So I'm trying to say, like, if you can understand what's going on with water, and you can understand what's going on and how fast that wave stops moving, you see what I mean?
That's a really, like, good thing. When we look at an iron core, or any man-made element, ingredient, metal, salt, like, we take malachite and we melt it down, it's copper now, right?
Yeah.
The dipole moment, okay, so when we melt it down, the atmosphere is impeding on that. It's glowing red hot. There's actually a certain amount of water inside of that.
Yeah.
Copper.
Well, there's water in everything. You know, even rocks.
water in absolutely everything, almost everything. We take glass, there's less and less and less.
Yeah.
But when we take that copper line, if we look at if we were to measure it like ppms, parts per million, right? Water, if we take it and we brush our hair and we put a comb near the water, it actually pushes away, right?
Yeah.
And now if we take an attraction force, like a magnet, and we rub it across a piece of metal, we see that it attracts to it. So a ferro material is an attractive force, and water is a repulsive force. If we look at copper, if we look at the elements that it's made out of, it's made out of a salt, an attractive force, and it's made out of a repelling force, a water.
Well, there's also, Ted,
we get a metallurgy, the domains where it goes back and forth. If we look at our AC, it goes back and forth, but it's controlling those magnetic domains. And that's little tiny compasses, basically. If you were to take a battery and a big, thick cable, right, with enough amperage, and you were to line that cable up in a straight line, and you were to place a whole bunch of tiny little compasses along that, and then tap the one end, you would see a ripple along those compasses. Well, that's is actually going on inside that copper.
Well, yeah, that's water is a dipole molecule. It says it has a positive and negative on there. There's also materials out there that are what they would call hydrophobic. They don't like to be around water. And so, you know, if you actually look, there was an experiment out there on YouTube where they took fish bile, you know, out of the, what is it, the kidneys or spleen? I can't even remember. Anyway, basically out of the fish, and they did this also with soap as well. They put it on paper and dried it out, and then they put it down in water, and you could see these papers that were covered with either fish bile or soap after they'd been dried out and then thrown into fresh water. They would start moving around by themselves. And the explanation that the one guy from what's his name, something lab, Action Lab on YouTube. Go check out Action Lab. You'll find the video I'm talking about. Anyway, he's talking about how once this gets in with the water, the hydrophobic portions of it are pushing water one way while the other one's trying to track the other way, which causes this thing to, you know, basically move. So you got a piece of paper that you just threw in the water that's moving around like it's got a motor in it. But it's because of the chemical reaction that's going on. Some materials are hydrophobic and some, you know, like water. You see what I'm saying?
But you get a different effect if the temperature was cooler or hotter as well, just like the sausages in the frying pan that are going back and forth, right?
Yeah.
Same thing, right?
Yes.
If the temperature would make a factor as well.
But what it all boils down to is that right now, everybody out there is looking for the holy grail of free energy. And I'm telling everybody out there that you've already got every single thing you need to do what it is that you need to do. Everybody would love to be off the power grid. Well, using all these things that are already in existence, including jet engine technology, when people sit there and they talk about how much fuel that actually goes into a like a 747 or whatever, a 380, A380s or something like that, I can't remember. Anyway, big old airplanes, passenger airliners, and they talk about how much fuel actually goes into that. There's actually a conspiracy out there that's now saying that that planes run on compressed air technology and don't use near the amount of fuel that they say they do. And so how do you get 83 tons of fuel inside of the wings and the fuselage and the tail of the deal? Now, regardless of whether it's true or not, the physics are there to show that if you compress air, which is a gas, while you're compressing that, you're sucking in hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen, and you're pushing those molecules closer together. You're compacting the hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen really close together. And at the temperature of all, from all the friction Like, let's say you start this thing up with a jet engine fuel, you atomize it, vaporize it, and you burn it, and you get a flame, and you get this center hot. From that point on, just like a diesel engine, you don't need to continue to run the glow plugs in a diesel engine because the compression is the ignition. Compression ignition is what a diesel engine uses. So the same concept could be applied in a jet engine, so that when you get this thing up to speed, it's got all that friction from pressure and all the compression of all these gases down inside there, which is producing a massive amount of heat, and at some point will produce its own ignition source. And as the hot gases are expanding and collapsing in between, you know, it gets compressed and then recompressed and then compressed one more time and pushed down, and then it expanded out the back of this deal. You got air pressure coming from the big fan on the front that's actually being turned by the air pressure that is being spit out through the combustion portion, causing this to rotate yet even faster, producing a vortex in front of the plane, which is basically like a vacuum, and it's sucking the plane forward while the pressure, the 70% of the pressure that coming off that big fan is your actual thrust portion, and the rest of it is from the exhaust of the jet engine itself, which the exhaust of the jet engine itself is actually assisting the blow-by air pressure that's going around the outside of the engine, causing it to move forward. So the faster you go out there, the more thrust that this thing produces, and the more fuel it picks up on the way through and uses it on demand. So once you've got this thing in the air, you can literally fly this thing from point A to point B and barely use any kind of fuel other than to sustain the temperature. All you have to do is keep that temperature inside that jet nozzle at the right temperature in order to get the chemical reaction, the physical reaction that causes the jet engine to function. The same thing is what I was trying to explain to somebody, is if you want to run an internal combustion engine off of water, you have to understand the physics of water and what water does under certain circumstances. Obviously, water is a liquid and you can't compress a liquid, but if you heat that water enough to put that water into steam, now it is no longer a liquid, it is a gas, and the more you break that down, now you can compress it. So if you begin to preheat your water before it ever even gets to the intake portion, by the time it goes through a preheater, through an induction heating system that is actually heating the cylinder of the internal combustion engine up to over 300 degrees Fahrenheit, by the time it goes through that system right there, the water's already beginning to turn into steam. And once it's up in the steam portion, then you run it through an atomizer, which breaks it down any even farther. And then you go to Justin's suggestion, where now you use sound waves, sonic waves, to literally break it down into the smallest possible molecule vapor. So now you're vaporizing this fuel into such a really tiny amount, and then putting that right down into that superheated piston. And as soon as that vaporized water, which is already primed and ready to go, hits that hot deal, it will expand 1600 times its volume, slamming that piston down through the bottom. And on the upstroke of that deal, the pressure, the heat, and everything that's going on inside there will crack the hydrogen and oxygen molecules into its separate components. And by releasing the hydrogen and oxygen molecules at that in that manner, it will actually produce its own electrical charge, which, because now it has oxygen, it has all three things necessary to burn. It has oxygen, ignition source, and a fuel source. And once that separation occurs and that little electric charge is enough to ignite that fuel inside that deal, now you get an implosion from the hydrogen and an explosion from the oxygen again. You get two bangs for $1, and every time you mash your foot on the gas, you will use less fuel because you understand of the timing of how much time you have to burn to get a complete burn inside this combustion chamber. And then the exhaust that comes out of the exhaust pipe That heat can then in turn be transferred around to assist preheating your water on the way through, so you're not even having to use any electrical at this point. Any vibration that's going on inside there that would normally be generating heat in the internal combustion engine is also used to assist that preheating of the fuel before it ever even gets to it. And then as it's coming out the exhaust, because of the purity of the exhaust itself being a gas, even after it comes out of the exhaust, by the way that you allow this to expand into an expansion chamber, either rapidly to generate cooling or it slowly in order to generate heat, you could now vent that right straight into the car, and you're getting fresh, warm oxygen into your doggone vehicle to keep you warm in the wintertime and cool in the summertime. And then you could turn around and use whatever's left over to literally condense their condenser system, because of the temperature difference between the exhaust as it's coming out and the difference of the temperature on the outside, depending on whether it's cold outside, will depend on how you condense it, vice versa, either way. And then you could funnel that fuel right back into the same fuel source and quite literally be able to pick up hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen right out of the air as you're driving. You're picking up more fuel through the entire deal. So at this stage in the game, we should have the perfect automobiles to give you just as much fun and power as you've got right now, but doing it in such an incredibly environmentally friendly manner and in such a incredibly efficient manner. It would just be, we should be in the space age right now, Justin. That's why I get so incredibly aggravated.
Do you know what Elon Musk's plan is?
It's hard to tell with that man.
you talk about control and servantius, the servitude, right? And enslavement and stuff like that on Sundays. Well, Elon Musk thinks that we should be underground traveling with our vehicles, whereas the rest of the world, as you've seen on YouTube, is trying to get off the ground in quadcopters and octocopters and be free.
Yeah.
Or that they want to control us more.
Well, that's the whole thing.
Now, they've got to build these tunnels, and it costs money to build these tunnels, but we, the taxpayers, pay for them anyways, but they're going to charge us to drive on them. And then they're going to put immigration checkpoints on them, too, and harass the people, too.
So why do we, the people, that's the biggest question of all, the biggest mystery to the universe is why, if there's 9 billion people on this planet, why the majority of, because it's only like the top 1 or 2%, and even if you went up to 20% of elite of the world or whatever, regardless, don't matter, all the people with the higher power structure, the base of the pyramid, so to speak, why is it that all these people allow such a minority to quite literally destroy their lives, pollute their waters, and cheat them out of the benefits of things like free energy? You even have the average Joe out there biting the hand that's trying to help them and give them the knowledge for free energy. They'll use the same laws of physics that were set out by the man to deny the possibility of free energy. Oh, well, this violates the second law of thermodynamics. No, it doesn't, you fool, because it's not intended to be a closed-loop system. It's not intended to be perpetual motion. And I don't care if it has a solar panel attached to it, so it has a secondary system to put more power into it, just as I don't care if it's got a windmill hanging off the back bumper putting more power into it. The more power that I keep in that battery is the less power that the alternator has to contend with, and that means that my battery doesn't get discharged, so my alternator never kicks on, so my engine runs more efficiently because it's not having to work harder. If the average Joe would get that little simple concept, we'd be done. You know what I mean?
When it comes to a rate of change in how we do things, we've always been a species that likes You know, the Big Bang. Oh, you know, the loud roar, right? Like, you know, I got a lot of friends that ride Harleys and stuff, right? And you know, Harley Davidson, you know, they just come out with their electric version, and you got KTM that's coming out with electric dirt bikes, and you know, all these new electric toys and stuff. But the guys, everybody still wants to see the big explosion, the roar, 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 right? You know, that's the way we are.
Well, you know, if that's the case,
it's the cool thing, right? Like, you know, listen, like on school, we see the punk rockers and the skateboarders and then the
I get it. But listen. If that's the case, we can even use physics or even sound to mimic the sound of an internal combustion engine to actually give them that roar. The engine that I'm talking about, being able to run on water, it wouldn't have the same type of exhaust sound that you would have under, you know, like the average modern day hot rod or whatever. It wouldn't have that rumble because it's designed to utilize all the powers and the energies and recycle fuels and such. And so if it was a case that they wanted to be able to have that loud acoustic sound, vibration, and feeling, we got methods by which we can actually replicate the sound of an exhaust system. It's pretty funny because if you look at some of the modern day Camaros and some of the hot rods they got, they actually have a switch to where they can switch it to silent exhaust or they can switch it to loud open header exhaust. Have you ever seen those?
Yeah,
so we could do the same thing. Even with an electric car, we can make that electric car go vroom vroom to make even those people happy. You see what I mean?
Right, but you know, it's the cool thing, right? Like everybody's locked in their mindset. Like not everybody. I can't say everybody, but you know, a majority of the people are, you know, locked into that fashion, right?
That's because like, loud says power, man.
You know, like, come on, there's nothing that's not elegant or vivacious about a Lamborghini.
That's because they say loud says power, but see, here's the thing. A DC electrical motor has a massive amount of torque, and that's why they're able to outrun gasoline engines, because they got instantaneous torque. You don't have to go through all the process of trying to force a transmission. It's like step on it and go kind of deal.
But if
we used to put cards in our spokes of our bicycles. Some of them probably would have been collectors by now, but and we'd give us that motorcycle run while we were pedaling our bike.
Yeah, I used pop cans. I wasn't foolish. I still got all my baseball and hockey cards.
Yeah, I should have saved mine too. I'd probably be rich right now. But nonetheless.
Like I'll give you a good example. When you're trying to achieve hydrogen, people use batteries or the wall or whatever method they're using. They're using amperage, and that is the wrong way. Just like when you talk about
the electrolysis process is the most inefficient way. Sound and frequency is going to be the way to go.
Well, right. When we say sound is just another. It's a decimal value. It's all these different things are all on a decimal value. We place them there on these decimal values, right? Like you got infrared from 400 nanometers to ultraviolet, which is up to the 800 nanometer range, right? That's the wavelength. We gave it those international standard units of measurements, and we call them these things. We can call them these things, right? But we see that sound itself, like if we take a plate and we take another plate and we send a frequency from one plate to the other plate, we're causing those two plates to vibrate, and there's a harmonic beat going on in between those two plates. Now when you stick it in the water, and you raise that up, that harmonic beat, it's still an electrical current, but we define it as sound because it's the decimal values moved over one place or two places or three places, right?
Yeah.
Which, like, defines it for what it is, right? Like, back to the tuning fork. If I flick a tuning fork, can it oscillate that diaphragm? Yes, it can. Now, that diaphragm has a magnet and a coil on it, and it can charge a battery.
Transfer of energy
is in so many different ways.
You just said the key right there.
When it comes to sound, I've been talking about transfer of sound and energy for so long. When you take a pop bottle and you blow into it, that's a resonate chamber. You can take an amplifier chamber and resonate into that, and there you go. If you have a surface area, you can make a sail, an air cushion, because you're replicating and compressing it. We even use it in our radar technology, back a submarine, right? The propeller is designed an uncertain way, you'll get bubbles, and those bubbles are called rarefaction and compression, cavitation, which causes noise. And that's the same basis of taking plates and vibrating them and causing it to create.
Wait, Justin, whenever you was a kid, did you ever see those little things that they put on bicycles that whenever you turn the little handle, like the handle grip, it makes a motorcycle noise sound? They didn't have batteries. It was just gears inside there, and the way that it shifted, and the vibration and plastic hitting each other, and the way that they molded the inside of the plastic actually gave it an acoustic sound, like rrrr, rrrr, you know. And so you could make your bicycle sound like a motorcycle. You ever see those?
No.
Yeah, well, I used to have one back when I was a kid. And there was no batteries to it. It was just when you turn the handle, it turns the gears, and because of the gear ratio, and you turned it up really fast, and it actually made a sound like a motorcycle going on. They were really neat. So we could actually, I was just kind of thinking back what we was talking about, if we made electric cars and they wanted to have the nostalgic old hot rod sound going to this car, it would be so ridiculously simple to take air pressure and mimic what the old header exhaust sound like, you know, like an old glass pack, because that's exactly what's going on. That pressure wave coming down from the exhaust rumbling through that pipe is what made the doggone noise to begin with. And that noise could actually be translated into electricity as well to, you know, help run the batteries. That's the whole thing. There is no such thing as wasted energy, folks. It's only wasted if you don't use it. But it's still there. And nonetheless, all that heat that is tearing up your engine on your gasoline internal combustion engine right there, that's all just going into the atmosphere. It's still energy. It's just going to either speed up, slow down, produce heat or cool or whatever. If you took and utilized the knowledge that we have at our disposal right now, you could build the perfect machines. You could build internal combustion engines that would be so ridiculously efficient, that you hardly even use any fuel. Just enough to get the reaction that you need.
Why do we need to use fuel? We're in, you know, the first electric bicycle was patented in 1900s, exactly on the 1900s.
Well, yeah, back in the 1800s, they had doggone.
That's 118 years ago, going on 119 years.
I'm just saying, listen.
But wait, hold on, 118 years. The first electric bicycle was patented, right? And here we are, just developing motorcycles and dirt bikes.
Well, here's what I'm trying to say here. Now, we could get completely away from what they classify fossil fuel. It doesn't matter. I mean, everything's fuel. No matter how you look at it, every single thing under the sun is fuel. If it's under the right circumstances, it's fuel. And so, with that said, if you want to stick around, because you just for some reason love what they call fossil fuel, which is a big hockahooey in science, but nonetheless, let them have it. That dinosaur fuel, whatever. All right, Big hockahooey. We're never going to run out of it. It's not even physically possible to ever run out of crude oil, but let them have their deal, all right? Even if you want to still use that, we have the capability right now to quite literally utilize that fuel in such a manner that there will absolutely be no carbon emissions. None whatsoever. And every bit of a carbon that would be in a generated from what's right now is due to an improper burn. The only reason why you get carbon monoxide out of this fuel or any other noxious gases is because of the chemistry in which they put in there and the way that these things are not getting a proper burn. When you mash down on the gas and it keeps putting more fuel, which requires more air and requires more pressure for the combustion in order, that piston is going up faster and faster and faster, shortening the time for a proper burn. And so you're wasting more fuel than you're actually using. If it was engineered properly, you would barely use any fuel, and any carbon that would be coming out of that thing, if it was even remotely possible that you could get carbon out of the back of it, would be recaptured and turned right back into more fuel. Carbon is fuel. Carbon is what makes up the whole doggone crude oil system. Carbon makes up everything on this doggone planet. Carbon is what plants turn into sugar for food, which is fuel. Everything that you eat is fuel. The way that your body functions, it is using fuel. It's turning everything into sugar and carbohydrates and all that kind of stuff. And it's you doing a chemical reaction, producing an electrical charge, a thermoelectric charge inside of your body that's running your muscles and your brain and everything like that. You yourself are fuel. And so with that said, if people can't figure this out here in the year 2018, that we could actually have perfect machines, then we're just going to have to keep on with the mad science show, pointing out the ridiculousness. It's ludicrous to think that here we are in the year 2018 and then somebody else out here in this world can't even get a fresh glass of water to drink. That's ridiculous. So, you know, it looks like we're down there to the wire, Justin.
Yeah,
I think this is a pretty brilliant show, if you ask me.
Yeah, it was a good show.
We should do it more often, now that we're on the same page.
But we've always been on the same page.
Well, yeah, but we argue a lot over terminology, and that's my biggest pet peeve with the planet, is because the average Joe, I'm not saying the average Joe ain't bright, because they are. Everybody's got their talents, but the problem is the way that the school system has pretty much indoctrinated people. If you ain't a doctor, then you don't speak doctor language, you know?
Did I go to school?
No, but no. See, you had a different education level, and so the way that you were educated, I'm not knocking it, saying that it's bad, but you did learn a whole lot of high-tech terminology that well exceeds any college student that would be out there that been in college for God knows how many years and come out with a master's degree or whatever. You could talk the talk with those same people, and they could understand the language. But the average Joe going through average school, working in the average job, they don't require that kind of language, because they're not trying to communicate with the doctor to the extent, you know, I ask the doctor what's wrong with me, and he says what's wrong with me, but if he writes it down in my paper, he writes it down in Latin, and I can't read Latin, so I don't know what the heck it's saying on there. He might be saying, I just talked to this scumbag and ripped him off of thousands of dollars for a Band-Aid, and in reality, you know, smile in your face or whatever. But the whole thing is, I try to put it down in the simplest example as possible so that everybody out there, because when I talk about giving the world free energy, I meant it. I mean, it's already there. You've already got it. You just need to learn how to utilize it and use it in a more efficient manner. And that even the electricity coming down your house, if you re-engineer the way that you're using the power at your house, there's ways that you can save electricity and lower your electric bill. And then, after you do that, that will give you funds for your research to be able to afford materials to do yet even more research, and if need be, go out and find somebody that you believe in and support their research and make sure that it gets done. But it's going to be the average Joe that makes it happen. It's not going to be any companies, corporations, or governments, or any of the supposed representatives out there, because their track record stinks. They're rich. They want to stay rich. They're powerful. They want to stay powerful. And the only way that they can maintain that power structure is by keeping you as the base of the pyramid that's holding up the capstone, which is the beast that is eating each and every one of you alive. If you don't believe in free energy, then you haven't paid attention in school. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough, because you're surrounded in it, you're floating in the sea of energy, and even you yourself are energy. Every single frequency out there can be captured and stored.
You know what's the best thing ever?
What?
Is that in America, up here in Alaska, which used to be part of Canada, you got Homestead, and you got, you know, the Northwest Territories, and way up there, where it gets really, really cold. And these people up there, they have their gardens, greenhouses, they're living off of the land, they're living with free electricity because they chose that way of life.
And they're doing fine.
And they're doing fabulous, excellent,
yeah.
They're highly vivacious. Right? Which means lively.
Yeah.
Right? It's what people choose, right? Like, okay, it's a trade-off. I can go to work for 40 hours and push some buttons, and then I can go buy myself some shoes and go get my nails done, or go buy some golf clubs, or, you know,
yeah,
make up towards my sports car, or whatever we choose is what we want. But, yeah, living together in these big cities like New York City and stuff.
Yeah, but see, brother, we could even make those better. It's that simple. But folks, we got to get up out of here. It's been a brilliant show, and Justin, I really appreciate it. I mean, you brought a lot of good stuff to the table, and you know, folks, if you listen to this podcast and you agree with what's being said in here, spread it around. The only way that we're ever going to get anything done is when we decide to get up off the couch and do it. And you know, if you've got to find a researcher out there, on this website, you'll find links over to Mark at Zero Fossil Fuels, RWG Research, and you can go with People for People Radio and hang out with those folks and have wonderful discussions with them. They got a lot of research and Rich Planet Industries, all these different links, TeslaMaker.com. We put them out here. We're not getting no kickbacks from these people. We don't do this stuff for money. We do it because we want to make this world a better place. And because mad science is all about that, you know, the ridiculousness of what you see going on out there in this world, people suffering, ain't necessary. It ain't necessary for you to be under the gun of the doggone power structure or the industries that are selling you products that are made to fail or anything like that. One hand to talk about save the environment, reduce your carbon footprint, and they're talking out the side of their neck because they do quite the opposite of what they're talking about. We have right now the opportunity, while we're standing at this crossroads in this time and space, to quite literally take all this knowledge, the vast sum of all man's knowledge, like my friend Simply Steve always says, right here at our fingertips. We have access to all this knowledge. Now it's time for us to network and come together, put this podcast on another radio network and replay it for somebody else and let everybody hear it. You know, everybody doesn't have to show up in this room right here. You go over to People for People Radio, crowd their chat room. That'll give us more room for people over here, you know. And this poor chat room's over here, so you got four different places that you can pile in. If you can't get in one side, you could find the actual link to that specific chat, like TC chat room and the two separate Shaziz and the Old Awake Radio chat room. There's room to go around, and if need be, we can throw a few more up in there, and you can throw your comments down in the chat room and interact with us like Stephen Gibbons does all the time, and Anon6193 in there. He said, yes, Shaziz, there is much work to be done. And so you write it down in there. We say it on the air for you. And so if you don't want to come on the microphone, which you can, join us on Skype. You can come on and join the conversation. There's just so much, man. And the as far as alternative energy research links, if you want to find out what's already been done or what people are looking at, scroll up right above the radio player. There's Stephen Gibbons' resource page. And go down there and look at the work that he's done. He's got links after links after links, researcher after researcher. And if there ain't something in there, throw a message to him down there in the chat room over there to superchat.html. And I'm sure he'd be more than happy to post that for you as well. Throw links to your researches. This is how we get stuff done, folks. This is how you get the answers to everything that you need. You got access to YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. Just use them. You know, these platforms out there try to censor people all the doggone time. Use their platform to your advantage. You know, I got a Facebook. You know, do I get on Facebook and socialize all the time? No, I check in every now and then, see who's saying what, writing messages or something like that. But I don't. My life don't revolve around it. Every time I make a YouTube video, it posts automatically over to Twitter, which then in turn posts over to Facebook. And every time I like a video, it posts over to Facebook and Twitter. And so that means more people will get to see things that I'm looking at that would be pertinent to alternative energy, green energy, free energy, any of those kind of things like that. And even sometimes comes into humor and human type stuff, which I'll probably be talking about tomorrow on the Knights of the Round Table. So if you want to join in on Knights of the Round Table, that's what we'll be talking about, all kinds of stuff from around the world. Saturday, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central Time for the Mad Science Show, which is today. Sunday, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central for the Knights of the Round Table. That's where we talk about current events and solutions and all that kind of stuff. And even sometimes on the Knights of the Round Table, we even go into some more mad science. So it's about getting information out there. It's about getting things done. It's about you networking and helping me network, bring people to the table. And we're not going to ask them for anything. We're not going to spy on them or anything like that. This is what it's all about. It's about just like the same concept that People for People Radio go for. People for People. It says it right there in the name. That's what there are. People out there trying to help other people. Bring them to the table. If they don't have enough room in this chat room, we'll make room for them in another chat room. And we just take all these networks that we've already got access, all this alternative media, and start combining it into our own giant. What's that phrase they say, Justin? You know, united we stand, divided we fall. That means they might take one of us down, but they ain't getting us all. You know what I'm saying?
I'm kind of the one that's kind of on the outs of everybody, though. The stuff I talk about is just like, cutting, smoking the rocks, moving the rocks, you know, spaceships, how they actually work. Like, I don't keep anything secret. I go right into detail. I can go into math, all that stuff.
Well, here's the thing. All those spaceships are scientifically possible. If we decide we want to build a spaceship, we got everything we need to do right now. Everything necessary to build free energy devices is right on the table. It just decide, you know, pick your flavor. What type of, do you want it to be? Hydrogen technology, electromagnetic technology, thermal, whatever. It doesn't matter, because we have every single answer to every single question, every single solution available to us right now. And if we don't take advantage at this time in the crossroads, eventually this information will scoot off to the side. It'll be in one of those libraries where you got to have the government's permission to go in and take a peek. You know, kind of like these special black ops projects that they got on certain areas where you can't go anywhere near them because it's all a matter of national security. It's a secret. Maybe they got a spaceship over there. Maybe that's where they get all this stuff that they've been messing around with. Maybe that's where your cell phone technology came from. Who knows? And who cares? Because we can duplicate it, we can replicate it, we can reverse engineer it, we could actually take every bit of technology and reinvent it if necessary, because you, the people, are brilliant, you're powerful, and together you make an unstoppable force, and that's why I'm trying to rally the troops, because I want to give this world exactly what I promised, which is free energy. Folks, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. Justin, thank you.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.